Hunt or Be Hunted, Burning Desires by C.H. Bordelon. Narrated by Tommy Carrera. Prologue. Thump thump. Thump thump. Thump thump. Thump thump. As his forehead begins to sweat, the sound of his own heartbeat is all the boy can hear. While looking down the scope, his target is finally in sight. The young but strong hands of a 9-year-old boy begin to shake. The boy is very nervous, though not for the fact that he is about to snatch the life from a living, breathing being, but more so because he knows his father is somewhere in these very woods with his ever-watching eye scoped down on him, just watching and waiting for him to make his first kill. As the deer lines up in the crosshair so perfectly, the boy takes a deep breath. It is at this time he hears his father's voice in the back of his head.
Boy, you best settle yourself. Get those damn hands under control, and remember, in this world there's only one rule in life. Hunt or be hunted.
The young boy steadies his hands, then squeezes the trigger, and the deer drops. It was a perfect shot. The boy is overwhelmed with joy, knowing he has made his father very proud. Little did he know, this was only the first of many kills to come. Several years later, he still feels the ever-watching eyes of his father scoped in on him with every kill, even though his father died when he was 16 years old. 30 years have passed since his first kill, and the boy has grown to become a stone-cold killer with one simple rule in life. Hunt or be hunted. Chapter 1. In the small but well-known hunting town of Greenland, Minnesota, Detective Harry Jones is called to the scene of a homicide. There hasn't been a murder in Greenland in 15 years, so it makes for big news. Jones arrives on the scene to see his partner, Jimmy Morstead, already there.
Hey, what do we have, Morstead?
Asks Jones.
All I know so far is that it looks like a long-range sniper fire.
Did anyone see anything? Jones asks.
Nope, and they didn't hear anything either.
So who's the victim? Jones asks.
Mike Lear,
Morstead replies.
Mike from the bar?
Jones asks, with a slight frown on his face.
Yep, that's the one.
I just don't get it. I mean, who would want to hurt Mike? Says Jones.
I have no idea, but I wonder what's going on with the moving truck. Did you hear anything about him moving?
Says Morstead.
Yeah, that was the word down at the bar, but I only listen to half the stuff I hear in there and ignore the other half,
Jones replies with a half-hearted grin. The two men split up and begin their investigation. Jones begins by talking to Lear's neighbors to see if anyone seems nervous or stands out, while Morstead searches the crime scene for any possible clues. 3 hours pass by, and neither Jones nor Morstead have any more understanding of who might have done this or why. Jones and Morstead decide to call it a night. Morstead heads home to have dinner with his wife and son, while Jones goes to his apartment to watch one of his many favorite reality ghost shows that he recorded on his DVR earlier in the week. Jones pops a large bag of popcorn in the microwave, pours a glass of sweet tea, and then he sprawls out on his couch to enjoy his show. In the meantime, Morstead makes it home to find his wife and son waiting for him in the living room.
Daddy, Daddy, Mommy, Daddy's home.
Morstead is greeted by his son with a great big hug around his knees. At 2 years old, little Jimmy has a very limited vocabulary, which suits Morstead just fine. Morstead rubs Jimmy on the top of his head.
Hey, Tiger, how are you? Get up here and give me some love,
he says as he picks up little Jimmy up in his arms.
Why didn't Jones come with you? I made enough for him, too,
Susan says as she walks into the kitchen.
He had one of those stupid ghost shows recorded that he couldn't wait to get home to watch,
Morstead replies as he shrugs his shoulders.
Why does he always watch those shows? Hasn't he learned by now all they do is scare him half to death and keep him up all night long?
Yeah, and then he calls me because he's hearing noises in his apartment. Who else is he going to call? Ghostbusters?
Morstead says as he starts to do a funky little dance move.
Busta,
little Jimmy says as he tries to mimic his dad's moves. Morstead and Susan both burst out with laughter. It's these little moments in life that helps clear Morstead's mind of the outside world. At 3 a.m., Morstead's phone rings. It's Jones.
Hello?
Morstead answers, still half asleep.
Morstead, it's Jones. You have to get over here. There's something in my apartment.
What? What are you talking about, Jones?
I think it's a demon. It's 3 a.m. That's the hour of the demon,
Jones replies.
And how do you know that, Jones? Wait, let me guess. It was on your show tonight.
But yeah, it was, and I thought it was bullshit, too. But when I started hearing noises, when I tried to fall asleep, please, Morstead.
All right. I'm on my way, Jones. Who are you going to call?
Me.
Morstead whispers to himself as he gets dressed to head over and save Jones from his imaginary ghosts or demons, as Jones calls them. Morstead does believe in the Bible as well as demons, but he also believes Jones has a very active imagination, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, he's not really in the mood for playing Ghostbusters. However, Morstead is a great partner and an even more reliable friend, so he indulges Jones once again.
Morstead finally gets Jones calmed down by making him watch a late-night comedy show.
Jones, I have to get home. It's getting really late, and we have to head back to the station in a couple of hours.
In the days following, there have been no new leads. In fact, the case is quickly turning cold. The case of Mike Lear has been cold for 3 months. That is, until one Saturday morning, when Jones gets a call from Morstead.
Hey, man, we have another murder, he says on the other end of the line.
Are you serious? We haven't had a murder in 15 years. Now we have two within months of each other, replies Jones with a strong tone in his voice.
I know, it's hard for me to wrap my head around it myself.
Who is it this time? Jones asks.
A guy named Joey Franks. Apparently he was moving into the old mill house out on Route 9.
All right, well, I'm on my way, says Jones just before he hangs up the phone. Jones is greeted by Morstead when he arrives at the old mill house.
Yo, Jones, we might have caught a break this time.
So soon? What is it? He replies.
It may be nothing at all, but I was looking around and then it hit me. The moving truck is from the same company that Mike used, so maybe, just maybe, that leads to something.
Hey man, it's more than we had last time. I say let's run with it, says Jones, as he pats Morstead on the back.
How about we head over there, flash some steel, and ask a few questions?
Morstead suggests impatiently.
You got it, partner. I'll follow you there, replies Jones.
The men get into their cars and head into town. Jones pulls into the parking lot right behind Morstead of the big moving truck company. The brightly painted sign on the building reads, Big and Little Johns. Need a truck? Big or small? We got them all. As they open the front door of the building and walk in, they see a very large man standing behind the counter. In the back of his mind, Jones estimates the man to be about 6'6 and 280 pounds.
How's it going today, gentlemen? Can I help you with something?
The man asks with a very softly spoken voice.
I'm Detective Jones, and this is my partner, Detective Morstead. We're here to ask you a few questions, Morstead says as he flashes his badge at the man.
Questions? Well, all right. I'll try my best to answer them,
the man replies with confusion on his face.
So I'm guessing you must be Big John, says Morstead.
No, sir. I'm Little John. Big John is my uncle.
So what's your real name?
Jones asks.
John Henry Post.
What about your uncle? What's his real name?
Morstead asks.
Jonathan Scott Post. Why? What is this about, officers? Replies Little John.
Do you remember a man by the name of Mike Lear or another man named Joey Franks?
Morstead asks Little John.
Yes, sir, I do. I remember Mr. Lear because of what happened with him getting shot and all. As for Mr. Franks, he was just in here the other day. He said he would be moving into town this weekend, so he needed to rent a truck.
Did he happen to tell you where he was moving to? Jones asks.
Well, it's part of our policy for customers to fill out paperwork, which have the current address as well as her new one.
Can we see a copy of that paper for both men? Morstead asks.
Yeah, sure. It's right here in the filing cabinet.
Little John walks over to the cabinet, sorts through the folders, and then says,
Here they are.
He turns and walks back to the counter and hands the papers to Morstead. Just as Little John had told him, it has their current and new addresses on them, along with their names and phone numbers.
So what's this all about, anyway?
Little John asks, while looking at the floor.
All we can say at the moment is that there has been another murder, and your company seems to be the only link between the two for now, Jones answers.
Hold on a minute. Are you saying that I'm a suspect?
Little John says, as he slightly raises his voice.
We didn't say that. We're just trying to put all the pieces together. However, it might be a good idea for you to stay in town for the next few days, just in case something comes up and we have more questions for you, Jones replies.
I'll be right here. I'm not going anywhere.
Oh, and before we go, who else works here besides yourself?
Morstead asks.
It's just my uncle and me. He's out to lunch right now, but most of the time we are both here.
All right. Well, thanks for your time and help. We'll come back if we need anything else,
Jones says as he heads for the door.
Glad I could help, detectives.
Jones and Morstead head back to the office, where they begin to do a background check on Little John.
Hey, Jones, I got a hit, says Morstead.
What did you find? Asks Jones.
Well, it turns out that John Post isn't so innocent at all. He has 3 felony convictions for battery.
How old are they? Asks Jones.
The last one was 2 years ago. He's only been out of jail for 3 months, Morstead replies.
Are you thinking that prison might have changed him and made him into a killer?
Jones asks with excitement in his voice. It is looking that way. I mean, the guy was a sniper in the military for 5 years, so we know he could pull off the shot. As for making the jump from battery to murder, people see into a lot of things in prison that will change him forever.
We need to pull a warrant and bring him in, says Jones.
We can try, but I think all of that is circumstantial evidence. We need probable cause or at least a motive,
Morstead replies.
Damn it, you're right. So I guess we just sit on him until he makes a move.
Well, we could bring him in for questioning, play a little good cop, bad cop, and see if he breaks, Morstead suggests.
All right, well, let's sit on him for a few days and see what happens.
If he doesn't slip up, we can bring him in for questioning, Jones replies with frustration. For the first night of surveillance, the two detectives are parked across the street from the moving truck company in an unmarked vehicle.
Man, this case pisses me off, and I've only lived here 7 years. How does it make you feel, being that you lived here your whole life?
Morstead asks.
Well, I haven't technically lived here my whole life. I did my 4 years in the military and met my ex-wife, but when she got pregnant, she wanted to move back home to California, so that's what we did. I was there for about 2 years, and the rest is history.
So what happened to your wife and kid? Are they still in California?
Morstead asks.
They are, but they aren't,
Jones replies as he lets out a deep sigh.
What? What do you mean?
Nothing. Don't worry about it. That was a long time ago, bro.
How long have I known you?
Morstead asks with concern in his voice.
I don't know, close to 5 years, I guess, replies Jones.
That's right, and you're a good friend to me. Hell, you've been my only true friend.
Yeah, says Jones as he interrupts.
Look, man, all I'm trying to say is, I'm here for you if you need to talk. If it helps to get bad things off your chest, whether they're in the past or not.
We got into a fight, Jones says, right before a long pause. Hell, I don't even remember what it was about. All I really remember from that night is that I got pissed, left the house, and went to the bar.
As Morstead sees tears building up in Jones' eyes, he says, It's okay, man. You don't have to talk about it. I'm sorry I pushed you into it.
I'm okay. It's just that I've never told anyone about this, so it's hard, but I do need to get it out and off my chest.
I went to the bar and had a few drinks. I remember walking back home, and I remember the overwhelming feeling in my gut that something just wasn't right. So I opened the door, walked around quietly, and then, Jones says as he pauses and begins to tremble. The tears begin to flow from his eyes, as he says.
Then I walked into the bedroom. She was just lying there, and I knew that she was dead. So I turned and ran to my son's room. I remember praying to God that he was okay, but I opened the door to find him dead as well. I never did get over it, but that is the reason I became a cop, and it is still what drives me now, says Jones.
Oh my God, I am so sorry. Did they ever catch the guy that did it?
Morstead asks.
No, they didn't. That's why solving this case means so much to me. I don't want these people to become just another cold case file, you know?
We will get the guy. I promise you, we will. Whether it's Little John or not, we'll find him, replies Morstead.
It is at this moment that the two detectives spot a vehicle leaving the moving truck company. Chapter 2. Jones and Morstead try to slouch down in their seats as the vehicle passes. With a brief glance, Detective Jones realizes there are two men in the vehicle.
Do you think they made us? Morstead asks.
I don't think so, but I sure as hell hope not, replies Jones.
Did you get a good look at the suspect?
Morstead asks.
I only got a brief look, but there seem to be two men in the vehicle, Jones says.
Do you think they could be in it together?
Morstead asks.
I'm not sure yet, but let's tail them and find out what they are up to.
The vehicle under surveillance cruises around town for an extended amount of time before it finally makes a stop at the local supermarket. The passenger exits the vehicle and makes his way to the supermarket entrance. The detectives notice that the passenger is Jonathan Scott Post, otherwise known as Big John. Then the unthinkable happens. The vehicle being driven by Little John begins to exit the parking lot.
Oh shit, man, they're splitting up, says Morstead, with a hint of panic in his voice. It's all right, calm down. I'll get out and stay with Big John, and you stick on Little John,
Jones replies with urgency.
Detective Jones keeps an eye on Big John at a safe distance. Jones' stomach begins to twist in knots as if he's just been struck by a sledgehammer when he sees Big John getting into a late model sedan with a woman.
It's a damn good thing the police department is less than a block away,
Jones mutters to himself as he starts off in a full sprint towards the department. Although Jones isn't as fast as he used to be, he's still quicker than most. Jones is 6'2", 225 pounds, with a nearly perfect chiseled physique. Jones reaches the department in a matter of minutes, where he gets in his unmarked cruiser. Jones then heads for the direction in which he last saw the suspect's vehicle heading. Meanwhile, Morstead is hot on the trail of Little John, which seems to be pointless for the simple fact that Little John is merely driving in circles around town. Suddenly, Little John makes an unexpected turn, heading towards an old country road. Morstead passes the road to create distance between himself and Little John. He continues his pursuit down the dirt road for about a mile, when suddenly, a deer jumps out in front of his car. He quickly serves to miss it and lands his car in a ditch.
You've got to be fucking kidding me,
Morstead shouts as he vigorously slams his hands onto the steering wheel.
What the hell am I supposed to do now?
He asks himself. He starts to phone his partner, but quickly dismisses the idea, not wanting to reveal Jones. The dreaded ringing of a phone is a sure way to blow a cover in a close-quarter situation. Jones scours the town, street by street, looking for any sign of the sedan. After a stressful and disappointing 2 hours, Jones decides to call it quits and heads back to the police department. He waits there for another hour or so to hear from Morstead. Not wanting to jeopardize his partner's surveillance, he calls it a night and heads home. Just before dawn breaks over the horizon, a beautiful middle-aged woman exits her house and approaches her vehicle. Just as she reaches the vehicle, the sun begins to peek over the skyline. She takes a moment to enjoy the beautiful array of colors in the sky. Little does she know, this will be the last sunrise her sparkling blue eyes will ever see. Unknown to her, at this very moment, a deadly predator has her in his sights. The killer begins to slow his breathing as he takes aim, lining the crosshairs of his scope perfectly with the wrinkle of her forehead. It is incredibly hard for him to be this patient, because he knows the great pleasure he will obtain from snatching the life right out of her body. He then hears the familiar voice of his father in his head, telling him to steady his hands. With that, he takes a breath, holds it in, and squeezes the trigger. The bullet pierces the center of her forehead and makes a clean pass exiting through the back of her skull. Now, all that remains of the lovely, beautiful, charming, and graceful woman are the brain fragments lying next to her lifeless body. Nearly an hour after the shooting, Mrs. Jackson, the victim's neighbor, is up making her morning coffee. Mrs. Jackson is a creature of habit. She wakes up just after sunrise, then proceeds to take her morning shower. She is still a decent-looking woman, although her golden years have long ago passed her by. In fact, just a month ago, she celebrated her 70th birthday. Every day for the last 20 years after her morning coffee, Mrs. Jackson slowly walks to the end of her driveway to pick up the newspaper. However, today would be nothing like any other day she's ever had in all the 70 years of her life. On this morning, she notices that her quiet but friendly neighbor's car is still parked in the drive. Mrs. Jackson knows this is unusual, so she decides to walk over and make sure her neighbor is feeling okay, or if she needs anything. It only takes a few minutes for her to realize something is completely wrong. She sees the body of her neighbor lying in a puddle of blood right next to her car. She then panics and, as quickly as she can, runs back to her house where she places a call to 911. At approximately 8:15 a.m., Detective Jones and Morstead arrive at the scene. The crime scene investigators are already working on the case. Jones and Morstead walk over to Mitchell Altus, which is the lead CSI agent.
"So what do we have today, Altus?" asks Jones.
"Looks like a single GSW.
Which translates in civilian language to single gunshot wound.
"To the head. The son of a bitch is good, too. The entry wound is exactly in the center of her forehead. It looks like a 50 caliber sniper rifle."
"Do you have any idea what the approximate distance of the shot might have been?" asked Morstead.
"Judging by the size of the exit wound and the scatter pattern of the brain matter, I would estimate it to be somewhere in the 200 or 300 yard range. It looks like the shot came from that direction,"
Altus replies as he points to a small patch of woods behind him.
"All right, thanks, man,"
Jones replies as he and Morstead begin to walk away.
"I'm going to search the woods that Altus was referring to while you question the neighbor that found the body,"
Jones says to Morstead. At this time, Jones notices a vital detail that could be a huge break in the case. He realizes that the late model sedan is a perfect match to the vehicle that he saw Big John get into last night.
"Hey, wait a minute. This might be the vehicle that Big John lost me in last night. Try questioning the neighbor about him to see if we can make any ties between him and the victim," Jones says.
"Roger that. That might just be as awesome as winning the lottery. If this really does break the case, I might just have to take you to Disney World,"
Morstead says as he lets out a slight chuckle. They split up and begin their investigations. Nearly 2 hours later, they meet back at the crime scene to compare notes on their findings. Morstead asks Jones,
"So, did you find anything interesting out there, or have you been taking a nap for 2 hours?"
"Very funny. You sure are quite the comedian today," he replies.
"I'm actually quite positive I found the area where the killer took the shot. However, I didn't find any bullet casings in the immediate area. It seems like he's the professional type covering his tracks, because the only thing I did find looks to be an impression of a body in the leaves."
"That's more than we had yesterday at this time, but I have a few more pieces to the puzzle, too," Morstead says. "The victim's name was Shirley Gardner. I also questioned Mrs. Jackson about Big John, and it turns out that she believes that the two were intimate with each other, although she was not formally introduced to him. She did see them together on more than a few occasions."
"It sounds like we should head over and start asking Big John some questions," Jones replies.
When they enter the parking lot, they notice that both Big and Little John were in the store today. Morstead parks the car close to the front doors of the building, and the detectives exit the vehicle and proceed to enter.
So how do you want to handle this?
Morstead asks.
I think we should start by asking him how he knows Shirley Gardiner, and then we can just kind of play it by ear from there.
Okay, that sounds like a plan,
Morstead replies, with a very impatient tone to his voice. When they enter the door, they see Little John standing behind the counter with Big John standing next to him. Jones pulls out his badge and announces their presence as they walk towards the counter.
Hello again, I'm Detective Jones, and this is...
Morstead, I remember. How could I help you today?
Asks Little John as he cuts Jones off in mid-sentence.
Well, actually, we're here to talk with your uncle this time,
Morstead replies with a deep, stern voice.
Me? Well, what can I do for you, gentlemen?
Big John asks.
You can start by telling us how you know Shirley Gardiner, Jones demands.
Who? I don't know anyone by that name,
Big John replies while keeping eye contact with Jones.
So, are you telling me you've never been to her residence?
Jones asks.
I'm telling you that I don't know her. So no, I have not been to her residence, as you call it.
Big John snaps back at Jones.
What about you, Little John? Have you ever seen Miss Gardiner with your uncle?
Morstead asks.
Look, sir, I'm not trying to be rude or anything, but this really isn't any of my business.
Okay, I get the point. You don't want to cooperate. I'll be sure to make a note of that,
replies Morstead. He was trying to bully him into answering the question. This is a tactic he likes to use, although it usually doesn't work. Jones gets pissed every time he tries it, because every time he does, the same thing happens. Nothing. It must be Morstead's lucky day.
No. Now there's your answer. Is there anything else, or can we get back to work?
Little John answers. Jones and Morstead head back to the police department to search the system for any legal reason they can find to bring Big John in for questioning. With the legal system today, there is no such thing as a shut and closed case. It takes countless hours of detective work to get all the pieces of the puzzle together to make a case stick. With every answer, there is yet another question. Every eyewitness account leads you chasing your tail like a dog, but every time you circle back around, you might find one more small detail. Every detail is important, no matter how big or small, when building a case like this, because all it takes is for the suspect to slip just one time, and you have to be ready to pounce when they do. There was nothing to be found in the system on John Scott Post, so they decide to take what they have to the chief and see what he can come up with. Chief Galloway is a man known for his iron will that never strays too far from the books on how things are to be done, which obviously is a method that has seemed to work for him throughout his career. When he was a street detective, no matter how hard the case may have been, he always got the job done. This is the same quality of work he expects from any man or woman that works in his division. So to put it simply, everyone knows you better have your ducks in a row before you even walk into his, quote, tomb, as his office is known around the department. Morstead and Jones sit on the other side of the desk from Chief Galloway.
Hey, Chief, we have reason to believe Jonathan Post may be involved in the murders around town, says Jones.
So, what evidence do you have to back up your allegations?
Asks Chief.
Well, for starters, he has direct links to all three of the victims. He is part owner of the moving truck company that both Mike Lear and Joey Franks used only days before the murders,
Morstead replies.
Does anyone else work there with him, or does he run the business himself?
Chief asks. His nephew Little John works there with him, sir. We know this could be considered circumstantial. That's why we decided to do surveillance on both men.
Look, I have tons of cases piling up on my desk that I need to look into. Hell, old Mrs. Green out on the dairy farm has been calling for weeks about a supposed drifter hanging around the farm. She's already called twice this week. So get to the point and tell me what you found out and what actual evidence you have,
Chief sternly says with his deep, raspy voice.
Sorry, sir. We followed both men until they split up, so I stayed with Big John until he met up and left with the third victim, Ms. Gardiner. When we interviewed Ms. Gardiner's neighbor, she stated that she had seen the victim and Jonathan Post together on more than one occasion. However, when we went to question him about Ms. Gardiner, he denied even knowing her, Jones tells Chief.
Well, it definitely sounds like he's hiding something. I'll call around and see if I can find anything on him.
Thanks, Chief,
both Jones and Morstead say.
In the meantime, you two run down to the farm and talk to Ms. Green about her so-called drifter, and maybe that crazy old loon will get off my back.
Jones and Morstead head to the farm to speak with Ms. Green about this drifter character. I don't know why Chief is even wasting our time sending us to the farm. Do you remember last year when she called and reported that there was an alien in her field? Asked Jones.
Yeah, she had the whole town in an uproar. I'm just glad it didn't gain any national publicity, because we would have had all those UFO-chasing freaks on every street in the city,
replies Morstead.
That's the last thing we would have needed. But I don't know. It could have turned out to be pretty fun, says
says Jones, as he burst out with laughter.
Oh yeah, how is that?
But just think about it. We could have bought some little green men outfits and ran around all the fields. Morstead begins to laugh uncontrollably.
I could picture us doing that. Oh, stop. I can't breathe. It hurts.
Yeah, but with my luck, someone would shoot me, and I don't mean with a camera, Jones says, with a crooked grin on his face. Back to the real point at hand, though. I don't really think Chief is wasting our time. Everyone in town knows how Miss Green is. So, if we don't show up and at least get her statement, she would show up to every town meeting for the next year and tell everyone about it, says Jones.
Yeah, I guess you got a good point there. Plus, it makes the poor old lady feel safer. I really do feel sorry for her being out there all alone after her husband died, Morstead replies.
I agree, completely. I've felt that empty feeling myself, and it took me a very long time just to move past it, says Jones, as he lets out a deep sigh and his crooked grin begins to slowly fade from his face. They pull up to the farm and step out of their vehicle into the dirt driveway. Both men slowly start to walk to the front steps.
Geez, I haven't been out here in a long time, says Jones.
Yeah, it really looks like the place is falling apart, Morstead replies.
As they begin to step onto the porch, the old wooden steps let out a loud, creaking howl.
Who's there?
They hear Miss Green say, with her creepy old witch-like voice.
Miss Green, it's Detectives Jones and Morstead. We're here to talk to you about the drifter you reported.
Oh, my heavens. I haven't seen him in a couple of days. I think he's been drinking the milk I was leaving out for the cats.
Jones and Morstead glance at each other as they try not to laugh.
Is that right, ma'am? It must take a pretty desperate human being to steal milk from a lady like you. And her cats, says Morstead.
Miss Green slowly opens the old wooden screen door, and as she does, Jones notices a few paint chips fall to the porch.
Would you gentlemen like to come in and have a glass of tea?
Yes, ma'am. That would be fine, Jones replies very respectfully.
Well, that will be just fantastic. I don't get much visitors anymore. I guess when you get to be as old as I am, everybody just seems to forget about you.
Well, ma'am, I'm sure no one really...
Oh, now, let me go get your tea.
Miss Green interrupts Jones in mid-sentence. Miss Green goes into the kitchen and comes back with a pitcher of iced tea and two empty glasses.
Now, you boys pour you some tea, and I'll be right back.
She heads back into the kitchen and returns with a big basket full of fresh homemade muffins.
I suppose you can have a fresh blueberry muffin, although I truly made these for the drifter in hopes that he would leave my tomato plants and the cat's milk alone.
Well, thank you, ma'am. That's very nice, says Morstead.
Speaking of the drifter, Miss Green, can you tell us about his appearance and how often you see him around? Morstead asks politely.
Well, as I told you earlier, I haven't seen him around for a couple of days. Besides that, I don't want you boys to go getting the wrong idea about why I call the police.
What do you mean, ma'am? Says Jones.
Well, what I mean is, I don't necessarily want you to run the drifter away. It's kind of nice having someone else around other than my cats from time to time. I just simply want to know if he's a good, decent human being. I made him up a bed out in the barn and left him a note and a notebook. I asked him if he would be so kind as to leave his name for me.
Well, did he do so? Asked Jones.
No, he didn't. I don't think he's even been into the barn.
What makes you think that? Jones asks.
Well, because the bed hasn't been disturbed, and I'm very particular on the way I make a bed. It's really hard for someone to duplicate it. Well, at least that's what my husband used to say.
Miss Green replies, as she lets out a skin-crawling, screeching laugh.
But anyway, I can't really tell you for certain how tall the man is, because I've only seen him at a distance, and it's usually towards the later part of the evening hours,
Miss Green says.
Well, does he have a beard or a shaved face, long hair or short hair, dark-skinned or light-skinned, African-American, Caucasian, or Hispanic?
Jones asks.
Well, he's a white man. I would say he has medium-length hair, not long, like some of these kids wear their hair nowadays, but just like he might need a good cut. He has a scruffy beard like you might suspect a man that's been on the road to have. I bet if I could get him to come inside and take a nice warm bath and shave himself up, he would be a really nice-looking young man.
Miss Green, how about you let us try and figure out who he is and where he came from before you go inviting him inside, Morstead says.
Now, you look here, boy. That's my tea you're drinking. It's my muffin you're eating, and that's my couch you're sitting on in my house. So you don't go telling me who I can and can't invite in.
Miss Green snaps back.
Oh, no, ma'am. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it like that. I'm just concerned
that if we don't know who this guy is, then we don't know what he's capable of. I would just feel more comfortable for your safety if we could find out who the guy is first. That's all I meant. Morstead quickly replies in his own defense.
Well, now, that's really sweet, honey,
she replies.
The truth of the matter is, I was really surprised to see you two gentlemen out here today. I know the people down at the police department see me as a crazy old lady that's always making up stories. Well, that may be true. I do like the company, but I will look you in the eye and tell you right now that this is the truth. Wait here. I'll be right back. I've got something to show you,
Miss Green says. The hardwood floors creak beneath her feet with every step as she walks down the hallway. Miss Green goes to her bedroom, and in her top drawer, she gets an old worn-out hat. Then she slowly creaks back down the hallway.
Now, you boys have a gander at this,
Miss Green says as she hands the hat to Jones. What is this, Miss Green? He replies.
It's a hat,
she says as she smiles, exposing her toothless gums.
I found that behind the barn one morning when I went to go feed my cats. My Tommy never wore a hat in his life. The only thing I can think of is the drifter must have left it there,
Miss Green says. On the front of the hat is a logo that reads One Stop Shop.
Hey, Jones, look at this logo,
Morstead says. I know that place. It closed down about 5 or 10 years ago after the owner went missing, replies Jones. Miss Green, it looks like you might have given us something to run with. Would you mind if we keep this hat for evidence? Jones asks.
That's not a problem at all. You just go right ahead. But please do call me and let me know if you find anything out.
Yes, ma'am. We sure will. You have my word. And thank you once again for the tea and muffins, Jones says as he stands up. Jones and Morstead head back to the department.
I think we should do a little digging around and find out what the owner's name was, Jones suggests to Morstead.
I think that sounds like a great idea. I don't know why, but I've got a feeling that Miss Green is telling the truth about the drifter.
After searching for any possible leads they could find on the drifter, it's almost quitting time on a Friday afternoon.
Hey, man, don't forget about the cookout at my place tomorrow,
Morstead says.
I wouldn't miss it for the world. Susan's baked beans mixed with all that hamburger meat, chunks of smoked ham, and topped off with thick slices of bacon. Yum.
Count me in, Jones replies.
Man, I know. Her beans are so good, they almost make a grown man want to go home and slap his mama,
Morstead says, with a fake deep southern draw accent. The next day at the cookout, Jones is enjoying the quality time and, of course, Susan's baked beans with his best friend and partner. Morstead is very talented when it comes to changing his voice and doing different accents. He's definitely known as a comedian around the department. Everyone is laughing and having a great time while they enjoy exquisitely prepared food.
Do you want some more beans, Jones?
Asks Susan.
No, I couldn't. I've already had 4 servings. I feel like a bird at a wedding.
Thank you, though. They were very good, as always,
Jones replies as he rubs his stomach.
What he's trying to say to you is that it seems he's had enough rice, woman,
Morstead says, with a nearly perfect Sean Connery impersonation. Everyone laughs uncontrollably.
Oh, Jimmy, do Clinton, please,
Susan says as she smiles and bats her eyelids.
All right, just once. But remember, this isn't fast food, so you can't have it your way all the time.
Well, just you remember who wears the pants in the family,
Jones butts in.
Oh, no, he wears the pants. I just have to tell him which ones to wear,
Susan says as everyone begins to laugh again.
That woman is a liar. I did not wear pants today,
Morstead replies in a very accurate Bill Clinton voice.
Oh, damn, Morstead, that was a good one,
Jones replies after catching his breath from laughing so hard.
Thank you. Thank you very much,
says Morstead as he slicks his hair back.
Well, on that note, it's about time for me to leave the building, Jones says.
All right, brother. I'll see you Monday morning. Thanks for coming,
replies Morstead as he pats Jones on the back. Chapter 3. It's Monday morning when Jones and Morstead make it back to the police department. After coming up empty-handed on the drifter, they begin asking around to see what they can find out about the missing shop owner. They talk to Mark Cole, a veteran officer with the department.
Yeah, I remember what happened. It shocked everyone. Tom Clover was the name of the man that owned the place,
says Cole. Did anyone ever figure out what happened to him? Jones asks.
Nope, and no one understood it at all. He was a good friend of mine. He had a great wife, nice kids, his business was doing really well. Then one day he drank his coffee with his wife in the morning, left the house heading for work like he always did, except that day he never made it there.
Were there any leads on Mr. Clover's whereabouts or signs of possible homicide?
Morstead asks.
We had nothing. All we could gather from talking to his wife was that he drank his coffee and left like he always did. He had an attendant named Joe. They would meet at the shop every morning. In fact, Joe is the one that called in when Tom didn't show up. We searched all over town, in the woods, everywhere. But we came up empty. We never even found his car. After a few years passed, the case was finally closed. Hell, I figure he's either dead, or we're never going to find out what happened to him, or he simply ran away and doesn't want to be found, replies Cole. What's this all about, anyway? Cole asks.
Miss Green called in about a drifter hanging around her property, says Morstead.
That crazy old loon.
Yeah, but this time we believe her, and she just handed us this hat, Jones interrupts, as he hands the hat to Cole.
I'll be damned. This is Tom's hat.
How can you be so sure about that, Cole?
Morstead asks.
I told you, he was a friend of mine. The man wore that thing every day. It was more likely to see him not wearing his wedding ring than his hat.
Did she say where she got it from? Cole asks, with an urgent tone in his voice.
Yeah, she said she found it behind the barn, and she also claims that the drifter left it there, replies Jones.
I just find it very strange that Tom has been missing for so long, and then out of the blue, his hat shows up at Miss Green's farm. I think I'm going to head out to the farm and see if I can get to the bottom of this, Cole says.
Jones and Morstead head back to the tomb to see if Chief found anything on Big John. Knock, knock, knock. The sound of human flesh and bony knuckles against hard wood rings out as Jones knocks on the Chief's door.
Yeah, come in,
Chief shouts out.
Hey, boys, just the two I have been looking for,
Chief says as they enter his office.
Please tell me that means you have good news for us, Chief, says Morstead.
Well, it's not great news, but it's at least enough to bring him in. It seems he had a ticket he forgot to pay a few years back, so you can pick him up on a misdemeanor bench warrant.
With how crazy this case has been, it sounds like great news to me,
Jones replies to Chief Galloway.
Oh, yeah, about Miss Green and her drifter,
Morstead starts to say before he's interrupted by the Chief.
How could I forget? How did that turn out?
Well, sir, I honestly don't think she's making this one up. She found a hat. She seems pretty sure it's the Drifter's. It has a logo on it from One Stop Shop. So we asked around and talked to Mark Cole. He told us the owner of the shop's name was Tom Clover, and he went missing years ago, says Morstead.
Did you tell him why you were asking about Tom?
Yes, we did, and we showed him the hat as well. Cole was certain it belonged to Tom. That's when he said he was going out to the farm, Jones says.
I guess he wanted to see what he could find out,
Morstead replies.
Shit. You have no idea what you've done,
replied Chief.
What's wrong, Chief?
Asked Jones.
Look, I don't have time to explain right now. You two just go pick up your suspect and let me go clean this mess up. I'll explain everything when I get back,
replies Chief with his stern, raspy voice. The two detectives head over to the moving truck company to serve Big John with the warrant, while Chief Galloway heads out to the farm. Chief knocks on Miss Green's door. Through the screen, he can see the little old lady walking up as she says,
My, my, what a surprise. It seems I have another visitor and the chief of police at that.
Hello, Miss Green,
Chief replies.
Well, it seems this drifter of mine is causing quite a ruckus. He must be pretty important to get the chief all the way out here so far from his air-conditioned office,
Miss Green says with sarcasm in her voice.
No, ma'am, I'm looking for Officer Mark Cole. Is he here?
Chief asks.
He sure is. He's sitting right here on my couch drinking some tea. Would you like to come in and have a glass?
Thank you, ma'am. That's very nice. But no, I just need to have a word with him in private. Hey, Mark, it's Chief. I need you to come out here and talk to me for a minute.
Chief could hear Mark grunt as he stood up and headed outside.
Thank you, Miss Green, for the tea and the conversation,
Mark says as he lowers his head like a scared dog.
Oh, no. The pleasure is all mine. I'm just tickled to death that I've had so many visitors today.
Chief and Mark walk down the dirt driveway to get some privacy.
What are you doing out here, Mark?
Asks Chief.
Don't try and play head games with me, Chief. We've known each other a long time, and you know exactly why I'm here. Well, since I already know, why don't you just tell me?
Damn it, Tom is back. I always knew he would come back one day,
says Mark Cole.
Now, calm down, Mark. The man has been missing for 10 years. What on earth makes you think he would come back now?
Chief asks.
You know just as good as I do. He's back to get what I took from him. Hell, to be honest, it wouldn't surprise me if he's the one committing the murders just to get under my skin. No, Mark, Tom is gone and he's not coming back. Jones and Morstead are bringing the killer in as we speak,
Chief says.
I'm telling you face to face right now. Tom is back and they have the wrong guy. Jones and Morstead are very good detectives and I'm confident that they have the right person. Besides that, even if for some chance Tom came back, he never hurt anyone in his life,
replies Chief.
Yeah, but going through what he went through after, you know, that would be enough to make any man want to kill. Mark, I understand you're upset, but it's not because Tom is back. The fact is, you have a lot of built-up guilt inside you, and you're always going to look over your shoulder until you deal with what you did. Now just go home,
take the rest of the day off, and talk to Jennifer about it. You can come back to work tomorrow and we'll see how you feel then. Mark, I'm not telling you this as your boss. I'm telling you as your friend,
Chief says with sincerity. Jones and Morstead walk into the moving truck company looking for Big John.
Hello again, officers. Did my wish come true and you're finally renting a moving truck?
Little John asks as he laughs out loud.
Where's your uncle at today?
Jones inquires very sternly.
He's in the back. Hold on a minute. I'll get him.
Little John says.
That's unnecessary. We'll get him ourselves. We're going to need you to step aside, please,
says Morstead as they head towards the back.
Hey, hold on a minute. You can't just go back there. What's this all about anyway?
You need to step aside and let us by before you go to jail for obstruction of justice. We have a warrant for your uncle's arrest, so just step aside and let us do our job.
They go through the swinging door, which is located behind the counter. On the other side of the door is a narrow, poorly lit hallway. At the end of the hallway, they can see a well-lit room. When they reach the room, they can't believe their eyes.
Oh, man, there's enough guns and ammo in here to start a war against China,
Morstead says.
And every one of them are legal,
Big John says as he cleans one of the long-barreled rifles.
Big John, we have a warrant for your arrest, says Jones.
A warrant for what?
Big John asks as he raises his voice in anger.
Looks like someone forgot to pay a ticket. That's why we're officially here,
Morstead says.
Hold on just a minute. I want my lawyer.
Settle down. There will be time for that later,
Jones says as he reads Big John his rights.
Well, I'll be a monkey's uncle sipping on some sweet pecan pie. Oh, my, my. What do we have here?
Morstead burst out from behind Jones. Jones turns around to see what Morstead is all worked up about.
Well, Morstead, that there looks just like a 50 caliber sniper rifle.
Yes, sir, it does,
Morstead replies to Jones. They bring Big John to the station along with the rifle. The first thing they do when they get back to the station is find Altus so he can run ballistics on the rifle and match it with the bullet fragments he found at the crime scenes.
How are you today, Altus?
Jones asks.
Just another day. Another dollar. Can't complain too much.
Here, this might make you feel a little better,
Morstead says as he hands the rifle to Altus.
This is a 50 cal. Where did you get it from?
We found it when we served the warrant on Big John. We're looking at him as our number one suspect, so we're hoping.
Hoping that I can match the ballistics to this gun with the bullet fragments?
Altus interrupts Jones.
Precisely, my boy,
Morstead says, in his best Christopher Lloyd voice. All three men get a good laugh out of that one.
Okay, I'll get to work on this right away, but be patient. It's going to take some time,
Altus tells Jones and Morstead.
Not a problem. We're getting ready to start the interrogation on Jonathan Post, a.k.a. Big John. If all goes well, he will just fold and confess,
Jones replies with that crooked grin back on his face. Jones and Morstead head back upstairs to speak with the chief. Knock, knock, knock. The all-too-familiar sound of flesh, bony knuckles, and wood ring out again. But this time, the chief doesn't answer. Jones knocks on the door again, and again no answer. They walk down the hall to the chief's secretary's desk.
Hey, Molly, is the chief in?
Jones asks.
No, he's still out. He hasn't been back, and I don't know when to expect him either. He hasn't checked in.
Molly answers with the most irritating voice you can imagine as she pops her gum between her yellow coffee-stained teeth. No one around the department can stand talking to her, not even Chief Galloway. In fact, the only reason he keeps her around is because she is his wife's first cousin.
Thanks for your time, Molly,
Jones replies as he quickly walks away. Then they head to the interrogation room where Big John has been waiting impatiently. As they walk into the room, Jones slams a folder down on the table in front of Big John. Startled, Big John jumps a little as he asks,
What the hell did you do that for?
Jones doesn't blink an eye as he stares Big John down. He then begins to slowly open the folder, exposing the brutal crime scene photos of Mike Lear's lifeless body sprawled out on the pavement.
What? What in God's name? Why in the world are you showing this to me?
Big John asks, as he can feel the palms of his hands begin to get clammy. I just thought you might like to see your hard work up close and personal.
Instead of behind a scope,
Morstead says, as he interrupts Jones.
What? What? How could you possibly think I had anything to do with this?
Look, Big John, you can save the Orphan Boy Act. We don't think you had anything to do with it. In fact, we know you had everything to do with it,
Jones says, as he stands up and leans over the table to put his face inches away from Big John's.
How about you take a look at some more of these photos to jog your memory,
Jones says, as he pulls out photos of Joey Franks and Shirley Gardner. Holding one photo in each hand, Joan pushes them so close to Big John's face, he nearly touches his eyelashes.
Look, look what you've done, you sick animal.
Big John leans his head back.
I didn't,
he starts to say before Jones interrupts him.
I don't want to hear your lies. We matched your gun with the bullet we found at the crime scenes. Do you want to take a guess on the outcome of the test results before you have to look the family of these victims in their eyes and tell them your lies? Now, I came here with one thing on my mind. I thought to myself, hey, maybe this guy just needs a break. Maybe, just maybe, he's sick in the head and needs help. So that's what I intended to do. But I can only do that if you let me help you.
Jones says with all the passion inside his body pouring out, like a pot of hot water boiling over on the stove.
You're crazy. I've already told you I didn't.
Big John starts to say before Jones interrupts him again.
Do you realize you're facing capital murder charges on all three victims? That means you get the death penalty if you're lucky. If not, then I'm sure you'll make a lot of new friends in prison that would just love to meet a white guy with the nickname Big John. Now, before you speak again and blurt out more of your lies, you better think really long and hard. I'm here to offer you a deal. I'm trying to get you the help you need and save that pathetic excuse for a life that you have. All you have to do is tell me why you did it. That's it. That's all I want to know.
I already tried to tell you.
Big John starts to speak again before Morstead interrupts him this time.
Look, Big John, you seem like a nice enough guy, so I really want to help you. Don't answer anything and don't say anything right now. We're going to leave for a while, but we will be back. In the meantime, I want you to think really hard about the situation you're in and what it is we're offering you here. When we get back, we'll talk about it some more. But keep in mind, when we do get back, the offer only stands this one time and one time only. After that, you face the judge and jury on your own.
The two detectives walk out of the room and head to their desks.
What do you think, man? Do you think he is close to breaking?
Morstead asks Jones.
I hope so. I truly hope so.
How about we run to my house and grab a bite to eat? Just blow off a couple hours. We will give him time to think and really let reality set in,
suggests Morstead. You go ahead. I have a little more work to do around here. Then I'll just stop by my apartment and grab some meatloaf.
By the way, would you tell Susan that I said thank you for that? And it's very good,
Jones replies.
No problem, man. I'll tell her. So it's 4:30 now. Do you want to meet back here at 6:30 p.m.?
says Morstead.
Sounds good. Now get home and tell Susan I said hello,
says Jones, right before he walks away. At 5:45 p.m., Morstead's phone begins to ring.
What's up, Jones?
He says as he answers the phone.
You need to get to the department as soon as possible,
Jones tells him frantically.
Is everything all right? What's going on?
asks Morstead.
Just get down here now. I'll fill you in when you get here.
Before Morstead has a chance to say anything else, he hears Jones hang up the phone. He then rushes to his car and heads straight to the department. The drive, which normally takes him 15 minutes, only took 5 this time. When he pulls up, he notices the yellow tape and police crowded all around the front steps.
What the hell is going on here?
Morstead says to himself. As he steps out of his vehicle, he spots Jones running in his direction.
Jones, what's going on?
Morstead shouts above the noisy crowd of onlookers that have accumulated in the street.
There's been another shooting, and this time the victim is one of us.
What the hell? Who is it?
Morstead asks.
It's Mark Cole. Whoever it was got him as soon as he walked out of the building.
Is Big John still in the interrogation room?
Morstead asks.
That was my first thought, too. But yeah, he's still there. Damn, this is getting crazy. I mean, right here on our own front steps. Just seems like a dream. The last thing I remember is I was headed to the Quickie Mart next door. Then I was standing here looking at Cole face down on the steps.
Jones says as his eyes build up with tears. Morstead puts his hand on Jones' shoulder as he says,
Look at me, man. There's nothing any of us could have done to prevent this. It's obvious that Big John and Little John have been working together, and there's no way we could have known that.
Jones simply nods his head. It is at this moment when the chief walks up.
Would someone like to explain to me what is going on here?
Chief Galloway shouts in anger.
It's Mark Cole. He's been killed, sir.
Jones answers him.
Mark Cole? What in hell is he doing here? I told him to go home for the day. The last time I saw him, this isn't happening. This just isn't right. He wasn't supposed to be here.
Chief lashes out at anyone listening.
And you too. I thought you were supposed to bring Jonathan Poston on that traffic warrant.
Yes, sir, we did,
Morstead replies.
Then how do you explain this?
Chief Galloway says as he points down to Mark Cole.
Well, Chief, the only obvious explanation would be that Big John and Little John were working together. So the next step would be to go pick,
Jones says before Chief interrupts him.
It sounds like a good theory, but completely impossible, because I've been with Little John for the last 2 hours. He was concerned about his uncle and wanted to know why we arrested him.
And what did you tell him, sir?
Jones asks.
That's beside the point. What you should be doing is trying to find out who really did this, because obviously it wasn't Big John. He's in holding. And I know for damn sure it wasn't Little John because he was with me. Son of a...
Chief says, right before he pauses like a big light bulb suddenly lit above his head.
What is it, Chief?
Morstead asks.
Tom Clover, Chief answers, as he shakes his head.
Tom Clover? Isn't that the owner of the one-stop shop that's been missing for 10 years? Replies Jones.
Yes, that's the one. Let's go to my office. I need to catch you boys up on the past.
Chapter 4. Jones and Morstead follow Chief Galloway to his office.
Grab a seat. This is going to take a while,
Chief says as he lets out a deep sigh. Jones and Morstead do as the Chief said. So what is it, Chief? What's going on? There has to be something we're missing.
Well, it all started when you went out to Miss Green's farm about the drifter. That hat she found belongs to Tom Clover, and Mark told you that. What he failed to mention was the bad history between the two of them.
What? He told us they were friends, says Morstead.
That was very much true at one time, and that's also what hurt Tom the most. Mark was having an affair with Tom's wife, and when he found out about it, he came in and talked to me. He wanted me to fire Mark. He said there was no way Mark could uphold the law when he was breaking it himself. Although I agreed with him, I had no leg to stand on. I couldn't just fire one of my best deputies on allegation. So I told him there was nothing I could do, and shortly after that, he disappeared. Of course, I had my suspicions that maybe Mark had something to do with his disappearance, but we never found his car or any shred of evidence that would lead us to believe that he didn't just decide to leave.
So do you think the killer could be Tom Clover? Jones asks.
I honestly don't know anymore. I never thought that Tom would be a violent man, but Mark sure seemed to think that Tom was back and coming after him for what he took years ago,
replies Chief. So what did Mark take from him? Asks Jones.
His wife and kids. He married Jennifer shortly after Tom disappeared and raised Tom's kids as his own.
I would say that's a pretty good motive to kill Mark, but why the others?
Morstead asks.
All I know is that when I went out to the farm to talk to Mark earlier today, he was convinced that Tom was back and coming after him, says Chief. He even tried to warn me and told me that he would be next and that you two had the wrong guy. Like an idiot, I ignored it, and I told him to go home and talk to his wife. Looks like I was wrong and he was right. That poor bastard paid the price for my mistake.
Chief, you had no idea that someone that's been missing for 10 years could pop up and start killing people. It's not your fault, sir.
Save it, Jones. I appreciate what you're trying to do, but the point is, I messed up, and someone that I've known for a long time is dead because of it. Could you just do me a favor?
Sure. Anything, Chief, Jones replies.
Make sure you get the son of a bitch who did this.
With that said, Jones and Morstead head back to Miss Green's farm to see if she can offer any more leads. Back to the squeaky front steps of Miss Green's porch, and again, she offers them some of the world's finest sweet tea. However, today there were no homemade muffins.
I'm sorry I don't have any muffins to offer you, boys. I already gave them to my new friend,
Miss Green says very politely. That's all right, ma'am. Did you actually get to see or talk to your friend today? Jones asks her.
I most certainly did, and let me tell you, he's a fine man. He was very polite and thankful for everything I've done for him.
Do you think you could describe him for us? Says Morstead.
I'm not very good at that, but I'll do my best. I would have to say he's about 6'1", somewhere around 185 pounds. I can just imagine how hard it is to find something to eat on the road. He has dark hair, kind of peppered with gray, though, and the prettiest crystal blue eyes I have ever seen.
Did you happen to ask him his name? Jones asks.
Well, of course I did. That would be really impolite of me if I didn't. He said I could just call him TC, and that he wasn't too comfortable sharing his name, so I didn't push the matter. I accepted the fact that he gave me TC, and now that's what I call him.
When was the last time you saw him? Asked Jones.
Oh, I don't know. Probably an hour before you got here.
Did he say anything about where he might be heading or what he's doing hanging around your property? Morstead asks.
No, he didn't, and I didn't push the matter. I figured in time if he's ready to talk, then he'll talk.
Well, thank you very much, Miss Green. That was very helpful information. We need to get back to town to follow up on a few things, but we will keep in touch with you,
Morstead says as they stand up to leave. They head back to the department to tell Chief Galloway the description Miss Green gave them. So Miss Green talked to her drifter today, Jones tells Chief Galloway.
And?
Chief sternly replies. Well, she gave us the description of a man. She said he's about 6'1", 185 pounds, dark hair peppered with gray. Oh, and she said he has the prettiest blue eyes she had ever seen.
Oh, dear God. Did she get his name? Not that it really matters, because I know who it is,
replied Chief as he starts to squirm nervously in his chair. The only name he gave her was TC, which I thought was relatively strange, but could be called off on coincidence, Jones answers.
You two look at me right now. This is not coincidence. This man is Tom Clover.
You need to find him and stop him now, damn it!
Chief Galloway says as he slams both his fists onto his desk.
We're trying, sir,
Morstead replies in a very neutral tone.
Well, trying didn't get Mark Cole anywhere, now did it? The way I see it, after getting Mark, he has only two options left. That's Jennifer or me.
Sir, we won't let that happen, explains Jones.
Just get out of my office and do your job!
Chief screams from way down in his gut as he points towards his door. As Jones and Morstead stand up to walk out of the office, Chief's phone begins to ring.
Hello, this is Chief Galloway.
What?
Quantico. What interest do you have in this case?
Chief asks. When Jones and Morstead hear Chief say Quantico, they stop in their tracks and turn back to look at him. The Chief holds up one finger on his left hand to tell them to wait. He talks on his phone for about 10 minutes and then hangs up.
I'm too close to retirement for all this bullshit,
Chief Galloway blurts out.
What's up, Chief? What did they say?
Morstead asks.
It seems that the national media has caught wind of our situation here, and they're calling this lunatic a serial killer by the name of Saw, which is short for Sniper at Work. Quantico says with the national media calling this a serial killer case, and the fact that the latest victim was a police officer, they're sending one of their top field agents in to take over the case.
What? But that's not right. It's our case. We work hard, and we're almost there. We just got the break that we needed, the last piece of the puzzle,
Jones says, as he slightly raises his voice in anger.
Right or wrong, it's out of my hands now. Do you really think I want the FBI snooping around my town?
Did they at least say when we should expect this agent?
Morstead asks.
They said he should be here by the end of the week, so the way I see it, you have until then to figure this out on your own.
A few days pass, with Jones and Morstead not any closer now to breaking the case than they were before they found out the FBI were getting involved. There haven't been any more murders or sightings of TC. In fact, there haven't been any more leads at all. Most of the people in town are welcoming the fact that the FBI is getting involved. On the other hand, most of the people around the department feel like it's a slap in the face. It's like the government is coming in to take over because they couldn't do their jobs in their own town. Saturday around noon, a brand new black SUV with dark tinted windows pulls up in front of the police station. Jones just happens to be walking up right at the exact same time. He sees a man in a black suit with sunglasses on step out of the driver's side of the vehicle.
Ha! It looks like their reputation on TV follows them to real life,
Jones mutters to himself as he walks over to greet the agent with a casual welcome and introduction. We've been expecting you. I'm Detective Harry Jones, he says as he reaches his hand out for a shake. The agent meets his gesture with an open hand.
I'm Special Agent Elliot Roberts,
he says as he shakes hands with Jones. Come inside. I'll introduce you to everyone, Jones says.
Thank you very much, but that won't be necessary. I'm going to have a meeting with the chief, and then I will hold a briefing with everyone that is involved with this case.
That sounds good. I'm looking forward to it, Agent Roberts, Jones says politely.
You can just call me Elliot, since we'll be working closely with one another. I know you're one of the lead detectives on this case. I will be sitting down one-on-one with you and your partner, Mr. Morstead, after the briefing has been concluded.
Agent Roberts enters Chief Galloway's office, and with an outreached hand, he introduces himself.
Please, sit down. Make yourself comfortable,
Galloway says. Agent Roberts then sits in one of two empty chairs directly across the desk from Chief Galloway.
I wanted to come in and introduce myself to you and basically give you a rundown of what to expect from me being here.
I certainly appreciate that very much, Agent Roberts.
To start things off, I would like to have a detailed briefing with anyone that is involved in the case. Afterward, I'm going to have a personal one-on-one with Detectives Jones and Morstead.
Okay, may I ask you why?
Chief Galloway says, with a bit of confusion on his face.
I would like to evaluate their state of mind, so that I may determine whether or not they are mentally capable of staying on this case.
Agent Roberts replies.
Let me be very quick to tell you that they are two of the best detectives that I've ever had,
Chief Galloway says in their defense.
I'm not here to question their ability to do their jobs. However, case studies have shown that when an officer dies from a case that one of his fellow officers have been working on, the surviving officer or officers usually take a lot of blame personally. This, in return, hinders their ability to do their job for that particular case.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, I guess. I just didn't think of it that way. Just do what you need to do, and you have my word that my man and I will stay out of your way,
Chief Galloway replies.
If you would like to join me, we should get started on the briefing,
Agent Roberts says as he begins to stand up.
We have a conference room right down the hall. If you want, you can get it set up and I will round everyone up,
Chief Galloway says as he escorts Agent Roberts out of his office. Everyone has gathered in the conference room.
It's about time that we get started,
Agent Roberts says as he shuts the conference room door.
I would like to start off by saying that I'm not here to step on anyone's toes, so to speak. My name is Elliot Roberts. I'm a special agent with the FBI. I would like everyone to try and think of this as a working relationship, much like the way the brain and body work together. Just think of me as being the brain that processes all the information and then sends out messages and tells the other parts what to do. Think of yourselves as my eyes and ears.
That's a whole lot of eyes and ears, Morstead says.
Everyone in the room starts to chuckle, including Agent Roberts.
That's exactly right, Morstead. Just think about it like this. If you had three extra sets of eyes and ears, you could watch the football game, your wife's boring TV show, and listen to her bitch about everything, all at the same time,
Agent Roberts says as he starts to smile. Everyone begins to laugh again. Morstead can't help but notice how intelligent and well-spoken Agent Roberts is. He really thought this would be a waste of time, but he actually kind of likes the agent. After all, Agent Roberts is making a lot of really good points.
Let me give you a little background on myself. I'm not a tightwad or all bent out of shape like most of you probably expected from an FBI agent. However, I do take my job very seriously, and I expect the same from each and every one of you. I was born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee. I grew up on the streets, and after several of my friends were killed due to gang-related violence, I quickly realized that wasn't the life I wanted. So I focused on school, studied countless hours every day. I was like a sponge, just soaking in all kinds of information, anything I could get my hands on. I would read it. I studied criminal justice in college and majored in psychology. Then I set a goal to become an FBI agent, and here I am today. My one and only objective is to find the killer. I will be completely honest with you right now and tell you that with my training, everyone is a suspect. Your neighbor, your mailman, your child's teachers. Anyone that raises a red flag on my radar will be thoroughly investigated. I know from experience that some of the people in this room will be subjected to some of these investigations. I'm not trying to imply that it is an inside job by any means. I'm just stating the facts. I would like to apologize up front to every one of you right now. If you feel like I crossed the line because you're getting investigated, I'm sorry. I'm just doing my job. I hope we can all work together and get this matter taken care of in as little time as possible. So if anyone gets any new leads, hears any new information, anything at all, come to me first before you do anything on your own. Thank you all for your time. Now let's get out there and get to work. I need to speak with Detective Jones and Morstead. Other than that, everyone else is free to go,
says Agent Roberts. Jones, Morstead, and Agent Roberts are the only three that remain in the conference room.
I asked you to stay behind so we could take some time to get to know each other better, says Agent Roberts.
My name is Detective Jimmy Morstead. Very nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you as well, although that isn't quite what I have in mind,
replies Agent Roberts.
Oh,
says Morstead, with a deer in the headlights look in his eyes.
What I mean is, I would like to spend some time with each of you, one-on-one. Jones, why don't you go grab some lunch, and Morstead can show me around town. We can meet back here in about 2 hours.
All right, sounds good. After all, I still do have some of that leftover meatloaf back at the apartment,
replies Jones as he heads towards the door.
Would you mind if we took your vehicle so you can show me around?
Agent Roberts asks.
No, not at all. It's parked right out front of the building,
replies Morstead. Jones goes to his apartment to eat the meatloaf Morstead's wife made for him. Meanwhile, Morstead is driving Agent Roberts around town.
So how long have you been on the force, Morstead?
About 7 years.
Is this the first time an officer has been killed since you have been working here?
Agent Roberts asks.
Yes, it is.
How are you handling it so far?
When I first started here, I told myself to expect things like this to happen. It's part of the job, I told myself. It's just
different. What do you mean by different?
Agent Roberts asks.
Well, about 2 years ago, we had an officer die from a heart attack. After some time, you kind of start to think, well, maybe it was just his time to go. That helped to make it a little easier to move on. Cole, on the other hand, he was murdered. He was shot in the head, leaving the department, like he did almost every other day.
Does that make you feel guilty? Because he was shot by the person you are chasing?
I wouldn't really say guilty. It's more like anger. I mean, whoever did this just snatched his time away from him and his family. I think about how Jennifer, his wife, must be feeling.
Will she still be waiting for him to come home from work with dinner cooked?
Will she ever be able to accept the fact that he's never coming home again? Maybe she needs to look in the eyes of the person who did this before she can accept it. It's things like this that I think about, and yes, that angers me. But it also drives me to bring the person that did it to justice. So hopefully one day she can have closure,
Morstead says, as he pours his heart out to Agent Roberts.
I understand completely, and will give you my word that no matter how dirty it gets, I will help you find the killer, and we will bring him to justice,
Agent Roberts replies.
Thank you, Agent Roberts. That really means a lot.
Hey, that's my job. That's what I'm here for, and just call me Elliot from now on.
After about 2 hours of driving and talking, Morstead pulls back into his parking lot.
Well, that's going to conclude the ride for this evening. I would like to thank you once again for keeping your arms and legs in the moving vehicle at all times.
Morstead says jokingly, in a strange voice as if he were a game show host. Both men let out a big, hard laugh.
I'm going to use the restroom. You can go ahead and find Jones. I will meet up with you in a minute,
Elliot says. Morstead heads to the conference room in search of Jones.
How did it go?
Jones asks Morstead.
It wasn't that bad. We just drove around and talked, pretty much hung out, really. In fact, I'm now on a first-name basis with Special Agent Roberts.
Wow, that's incredible. And it only took you 2 hours, replies Jones.
What can I say? I just have that effect on people,
Morstead says with a smile on his face. Just a few moments later, Elliot walks up.
Jones, did you enjoy your meatloaf?
Elliot asks.
Yes, I did. It was really good. How about we go for a walk, Jones?
Elliot suggests.
That sounds good. I could use a little fresh air, Elliot,
Jones says as he looks back at Morstead with a grin and a quick wink. Elliot and Jones head out of the building.
Did you grow up around this area?
Elliot asks. Kind of. I was raised in Green Lake, not very far from here.
So, Jones, how long have you and Morstead been partners?
Elliot asks. Pretty close to 5 years, I would say.
He's definitely a character. He seems like a really good guy with a great sense of humor,
Elliot says. He is a great guy and a really good partner. I trust him with my life.
So it's safe to say that you know him pretty well,
Elliot says. Almost as good as I know myself. He's not only my partner, he's also my best friend. I would take a bullet for him.
How would you say he's handling the pressure of losing a fellow officer on the job?
He's doing well. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's still fresh and we still have our moments, but overall he's handling it really good, Jones replies.
Well, that's good to hear. So tell me, Jones, how are you doing with the loss of a fellow officer?
Elliot asks. About the same as everyone else, just taking it one day at a time and staying focused on the point at hand.
Oh, and what might that be?
Elliot asks. Finding the killer, closing this case and getting my job done. Look, Elliot, I'm going to cut to the chase. I understand what you're doing here. You seem like you're really good at your job. That's why I'm playing along with your little evaluation game. Let me just tell you something that you don't know about me.
Okay, I'm listening,
Elliot says. My wife and son were murdered years ago, and their killer was never found or brought to justice. I never had that closure in my life. That's what drives me, and that's what made me become a cop and strive harder and harder every day to become better than I was the day before. I don't want to have to look at Mark Cole's wife in the eyes 5 years from now and tell her that we still don't know who did it. I know the burden she has right now and the pain it causes. You can go to bed dreaming about it, but all you see is a shadow where the person's face should be. You wake up every morning wondering, is this the day I get to find out and have closure? For some of us, that day never comes. But as long as I have this badge, I will do whatever it takes to make sure that doesn't happen again.
All right, Jones. All right, I owe you an apology. I misjudged you. I figured you were starting to break under all this pressure. But after hearing you speak about the past and the future, I can honestly say that I'm glad to have you on the case.
The next day, Agent Roberts contacts Chief Galloway to share with him the results of the evaluation on Jones and Morstead.
Agent Roberts, how did everything go yesterday?
Chief asks.
It went very well, and I wanted to stop by and tell you personally that you were right about Jones and Morstead. I can tell that they have the fire and passion that it takes to be great detectives. I also think that we're very lucky to have them on our side.
Does that mean you think they're capable of continuing on the case?
Chief Galloway asks.
That is exactly what it means, and I just thought you should hear from me personally.
Thank you, Agent Roberts.
Agent Roberts then meets with Jones and Morstead to review all of the case files and go over any leads that they've had so far. After reading all of the files and getting caught up to speed on Tom Clover, he begins to construct a plan on how to track him down and capture him. He finally finishes his plan, after working on it all day, and decides to call it quits for the night. Elliot is unlocking the door to his hotel room, when suddenly he gets the overwhelming feeling that someone is watching him. He's been getting those feelings, or vibes, as his mother called them, since he was a young boy. Growing up on the streets of Memphis, Elliot has learned very quickly not to ignore these feelings. So he quickly turns around with his high-powered FBI-issued flashlight in his hand. He shines his bright light into the dark woods behind him. Sure enough, he sees a reflection, much like the reflection from the lens on a scope would give off. He quickly draws his gun and shoots in that direction, about 10 feet higher than the reflection. Elliot runs as fast as he can, which is fairly fast, being that he was a track star in college. He hears the sound of leaves rustling in the dark as he approaches the woods.
Stop! This is the FBI!
He shouts. Even though it's far too dark for him to see anyone, Elliot scans the woods with his flashlight before he enters. After a few moments, his His light stops on a dark figure about 20 yards deep into the woods. He can tell that the figure is wearing a dark hooded coat or hoodie, and that the figure has his back turned to him with his hands in the air.
"I have my gun drawn on you, and I'm walking in your direction. If you move, I will shoot,"
Agent Roberts shouts. After walking about 5 feet into the woods, his feet get tangled in some kind of vine, which causes him to fall hard face first, dropping his gun and flashlight. He hears the killer begin to run. Elliot quickly jumps to his feet and takes off in a dead sprint after him. It doesn't take Elliot very long to lose the killer in the dark, unfamiliar woods. He stops running after he can no longer see or hear any signs of the killer. He then turns around and heads back in the direction he came from. However, in the middle of all the commotion and adrenaline, he's gotten further off course than he realizes. Lost and blinded by the darkness, it takes Elliot nearly an hour to make it back to the edge of the woods. He can see the lights of his hotel shining a block away. He tries to retrace his steps of when he first entered the woods after the killer.
"Where is my shit?"
he blurts out as he's beginning to show signs of frustration. After searching for his gun and flashlight another 30 minutes, he decides to go back to the hotel room and call Jones and Morstead. When Elliot reaches the door of his hotel room, he notices his gun and flashlight are hanging on the doorknob with what looks to be military-grade tripwire.
"I bet that's how he tripped me in the woods. He set me up,"
Elliot thinks to himself. He then notices a small piece of paper jammed between the door and the frame. At the top of the piece of paper, it reads, "I thought you might like to have your things back. Who knows? You might need them the next time we meet." The rest of the page consists of a list of names. All of the previous victims' names are on the list and crossed out. He notices that his name is on the list with a question mark next to it. There are four other names on the list as well. Jennifer Cole, Chief Galloway, Jimmy Morstead, and Harry Jones. Chapter 5. Elliot is more ready now than ever to put his plan into action. He sits down with Jones, Morstead, and the chief to go over the details of the plan with them.
"I worked all day yesterday on a plan to capture Tom Clover, while at the same time I want to minimize the chances of casualties or injuries. After the close call I had last night, I think it's time to get the ball rolling,"
Elliot says.
"What do you have in mind, Agent Roberts?"
Chief asks.
"We need to talk Miss Green into helping us."
"How are we supposed to do that? She's not really the type to betray anyone's trust," Jones says.
"Wait, I see where you're going with this. We have to make her think she's helping him," Morstead says.
"Exactly. All we have to do is play the guilt card on her. We will simply explain that we will capture him, and if she doesn't help us, there's a chance he might be injured or killed," replies Elliot.
"I think that just might work,"
Chief says, as Jones nods his head in agreement.
"I have a question, though," Morstead says. "If Tom is basically using her place as a hideout and just comes and goes as he pleases, how are we supposed to get out there without being on his radar?"
"I figured the first thing we need to do is to get Miss Green on board. We will have her casually set up the next meeting with him. You said she baked him some muffins before. Well, that's our way in. All we have to do is tell her that the next time she sees him, to tell him she's going to make him some muffins the following morning. Then after she talks with him, she will call us and tell us the meeting is set up. Later that night, we will sneak into position and wait until he shows,"
Elliot says.
"It sounds like a really good plan,"
Chief says.
"Chief Galloway and I are going to speak to Ms. Green so we can get her on board, while the two of you try to dig up any more history you can find on Tom Clover."
Jones and Morstead begin to run an extensive background check on Tom Clover.
"This guy is clean. He doesn't even have a speeding ticket," says Morstead.
"They say it's always the quiet ones you have to watch out for the most," Jones replies. They continue to dig, but once again come up empty-handed.
"There just isn't anything on him. He wasn't in the military, so military records are out of the question. No history of a juvenile record. I don't know, man. How does someone like this with no previous history of violence or anything just disappear for 10 years and then come back as a killer?"
Morstead says. "I guess he just had a long time to think about the people he feels did him wrong. The guy lost his wife and kids to one of his best friends. That's a lot of anger to have built up for 10 years, Jones replies.
"I guess you're right. I mean, I don't know what I'd do."
Chief Galloway and Elliot return to the department with good news.
"All right, gentlemen, she's on board. It's game time now. All we have to do is wait for her to call,"
says Elliot.
"We need to go over the plan of attack. I scouted out the area while we were there today. I will be stationed here on the front side of the barn,"
Elliot says, as he points to a dot on the map.
"Morstead, you will be here,"
Elliot says as he points to a dot on the back right-hand corner of the barn.
"Jones, the back left corner of the barn is yours. If you haven't noticed, we're making a triangle around the barn. That way, all sides are visible by at least one of us at all times,"
Elliot explains.
"Where's my dot?"
Chief Galloway asks.
"Chief, I would like you to be inside with Miss Green to make sure she stays out of the way,"
I could do that.
Good. Now that everyone knows their positions, let's figure out how we're going to bring him down peacefully, says Elliot. Miss Green is supposed to meet with him at the back of the barn. Obviously, she won't be in the line of fire. She will be inside. So once Tom shows up, I need you two to close in from behind him. If he tries to run around the barn, I'll be waiting for him in the front.
This is an excellent plan. Now I see why FBI agents get paid the big bucks,
Morstead says as he cracks a smile.
Now that everyone knows their roles, just be ready. When we get the call, we will meet here at the rally point, Elliot says.
3 days have gone by with no word from Ms. Green. It's 7:30 p.m., and the chief's home phone begins to ring.
Hello, this is Chief Galloway.
Chief, this is Miss Green. I was calling to let you know that I spoke with Tom this evening, and he has agreed to meet me behind the barn at 7:30 tomorrow morning.
Thank you very much, Miss Green. I will call the others, and we will be en route to your place later tonight. Are you certain he will be there?
Chief asks.
I'm sure of it. I told him I wanted to cook him a nice warm breakfast, so he agreed.
All right, thanks again, ma'am. We will see you tonight, then,
Chief Galloway says, before he hangs up the phone. Chief Galloway then calls Elliot to share the good news. In return, Elliot calls Jones and Morstead. It is now 8:30 p.m., and all four men are gathered at the rally point.
I want everyone to be extremely careful. We're all going to stay in the house until 5:30 a.m., then we will move into position, says Elliot.
Just before 9:30 p.m., they park on a long, secluded dirt road 2 miles away from Miss Green's farm and hike through the woods the rest of the way. By the time they make it to her house, it is now shortly after 11 p.m.
Everyone needs to get some rest. We all need to be in top shape tomorrow,
Elliot says as he sets his alarm for 3:30 a.m.
Cock-a-doodle-doo! Cock-a-doodle-doo!
The sound of a rooster begins to echo from Elliot's phone. He reaches and turns it off as he notices the other three men sitting on the couch wide awake.
Looks like you're the only one that got some sleep around here, says Morstead.
All four men let out a light chuckle.
It's time to gather ourselves and get ready, Elliot tells them.
We have coffee going and Miss Green left us some muffins that she baked yesterday,
Chief Galloway says.
That sounds nice, Elliot replies.
Yeah, the last thing we need is for our growling bellies to give our position away,
Morstead adds. Never a dull moment with you around, Morstead, Jones says as they begin to laugh.
All right, guys, that's enough joking around. It's time to get serious and get focused,
Chief Galloway says. After drinking several cups of coffee, eating muffins, and changing into their camouflage clothes, it is now 5:30 a.m. Elliot, Jones, and Morstead are all ready to get into position. As they begin to walk out the back door, Elliot whispers,
We'll give him until 9 a.m. to show up. If he's not here by then, he's either seen us or not coming at all.
Roger that, Jones says, and nods his head. The three men move into their position. From his position, Elliot can see the front and both sides of the barn, but both Morstead and Jones are out of his line of sight. However, Jones and Morstead do have a clean view of each other and their surroundings. After nearly a few hours of waiting, fatigue is beginning to set in on Jones. His eyelids begin to feel like they weigh 100 pounds each. He fights the urge to close his eyes. Finally, his eyelids win the battle and his eyes close shut. Jones can see vivid images of his wife and his son's brutally murdered bodies. He then suddenly opens his eyes and looks at his watch. It is 8:22 a.m. This bastard isn't going to show, Jones thinks to himself as he stands up. Morstead hears the movement and looks in the direction of Jones. Morstead slowly pumps the palms of his hands toward the ground, and then he points at his watch. With Jones continuing to head in his direction, Morstead throws both his hands in the air, as if he were trying to ask Jones what he is doing. As Jones approaches closer, Morstead whispers,
What the hell are you doing? It's not time yet.
Jones whispers back,
I don't know, man. I just had a sudden urge and thought we should be closer together. All right, man. I will watch over here. You just make sure you cover my back, partner,
Morstead says, as he points to the woods behind him.
I have your back covered,
Jones says, as he slips his hand into his coat pocket. Jones pulls out a pair of latex gloves from the pocket of his coat and slides them over his hands. He slowly reaches for the throwaway gun that he has strapped to his ankle. Then Jones points the gun at the back of Morstead's head.
Click, click,
Jones makes a sound with his mouth to gain the attention of Morstead. As Morstead turns around, he sees the gun that Jones has pointed at him.
What are you doing? Now's not the time to play around. Clover could show up at any minute.
Look at my face. Does it look like I'm playing?
Jones says, as he shoves the gun within inches of Morstead's face.
Jones, what's going on? What's wrong with you?
There's absolutely nothing wrong with me. In fact, everything's perfect. I mean, come on, a drifter that turns out to be a man that's been missing for 10 years suddenly shows back up and just happens to have a personal vendetta against some people in town? It was just too perfect not to frame him for the murders.
What? Jones?
What? No. Are you saying you killed all those people?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Smile, because you get to be the next victim. Jones answers with that crooked grin on his face.
Jones, please, please don't do this, man. Think about Susan and my son. They love you. Hell, I love you. You're my best friend.
Morstead pleads as his eyes begin to fill up with tears.
Wow, this is really disappointing. No funny jokes with your last words to me? I mean, what did you expect, for me to just change my mind because you threw your wife and son into the equation? Do you really think that my own wife didn't beg for her and my son's life before I killed them?
Jones asks as he begins to laugh.
Oh my God, Jones.
Morstead begins to say before Jones interrupts him. Save it. I really don't want to hear what you have to say. I learned a long time ago that there's only one rule in life. Hunt or be hunted. As for myself, Jimmy boy, I prefer to hunt. Jones says right before he squeezes the trigger and shoots Morstead in the head. Jones then hears the sound of someone running in the woods. It's Tom Clover. He has seen and heard the whole thing. Jones fires three shots at Tom. Then he immediately puts the gun back around his ankle and the gloves back into his pocket.
No! Morstead, no!
Jones shouts as he drops to his knees and pulls Morstead's body close to his.
Elliot, it's Tom. He's here. He killed Morstead.
Jones yells out loud. Moments later, Elliot comes running up.
He ran off that way,
Jones says as he points into the woods.
I fired three shots. I think I may have wounded him.
Without hesitation, Elliot takes off into the woods after Tom.
You're not getting away from me this time,
Elliot says to himself. But Tom knows these woods like the back of his hand, and there's no trace of him anywhere. Four lonely days pass by, as everyone around the department is trying to get used to not hearing Morstead's jokes or voice impersonations. Today is the day of Morstead's funeral, and Jones has been elected to be one of the pallbearers. As he carries the casket, Jones thinks to himself, I'm sorry, Morstead, but that was the opportunity I needed to frame Clover for good. After the funeral, Elliot, Chief Galloway, and Jones meet back at the department.
We've placed the black and white outside Jennifer Cole's house until we catch Tom. Elliot thinks she will be his next victim,
Chief Galloway says. Well, I hope he comes after me first, says Jones, playing the part of the grieving friend very well.
Jones, we're all upset, and I know it must have hurt you the most. I can't imagine what you're feeling right now, but we have to stay professional and do our best to bring him in alive so he can pay for his crimes,
says Chief Galloway. You're right, Chief. I would much rather see him rot in a jail cell for the rest of his life than get the easy way out, Jones replies. Has there been any more information on the whereabouts of Clover? Jones asks.
No, we haven't heard anything at all, but when we do, you'll be the first person I call,
replies Elliot. Thanks, says Jones as he exits the room.
Where are you going, Jones?
Chief Galloway asks. I think I'm just going to go home for the rest of the day and get my mind right. Chief Galloway nods his head.
Hey, Jones, don't forget, I still need your official report,
Elliot reminds him.
All right, I won't,
replies Jones. After Jones leaves, Elliot and the chief continue their conversation.
Do you think he will be okay?
Chief Galloway asks.
Yes, I do. If I didn't, I would have already pulled him off the case. I just can't imagine that any of us want to see Morstead's killer brought to justice more than Jones does,
Elliot replies.
I just hope that happens before it tears him up inside,
says Chief Galloway.
We're close, Chief. We're real close, and all it's going to take is for the killer to slip that one time. Yeah, I guess you're right. It's getting late. I'm going to call it a day,
Chief Galloway says before he leaves the room. With the images of Morstead begging for his life playing over and over in his mind, Jones tosses and turns in his bed. Unable to fall asleep, he looks at the clock next to his bed. It's 1:30 a.m. He gets out of bed and takes a shower. Then suddenly, he knows what he has to do. He goes to his closet in the hall and grabs a large black duffel bag. He then walks back to his bedroom and grabs a large hunting knife from underneath his bed and places it in the bag. In the top drawer of his computer desk, there is a roll of military-grade tripwire, which he also places into the bag. Jones then leaves his apartment and puts the bag in the trunk of his car. Braxton Cones is a 22-year-old rookie street cop that has been placed on the protection detail of Miss Cole. He sits in his squad car while he tries to complete a crossword puzzle. Tap, tap, tap. The sound of someone tapping on his window startles him. Braxton rolls the window down.
You scared me, Detective Jones. So what brings you out here at this time of night?
Braxton asks. Jones leans his head into the vehicle as he reaches for the knife that's tucked in his pants behind his back. Jones whispers, there's a killer on the loose out here. You should be extremely careful. Not having much in the way of detective skills, Braxton fails to realize that Jones is wearing latex gloves. With one quick motion, Jones pulls the knife from behind his back and slices the young cop's throat. As Braxton frantically grabs at his throat, Jones stands there with a smile on his face. Jones watches in admiration as the life fades from the young man's eyes. Jones then makes his way to Jennifer Cole's back door. With a quick flick and a hard thrust, Jones pries the door open with his knife. Jones knows that Jennifer Cole's children have all grown up and moved away. So with Mark now dead, she lives alone. Before heading upstairs to her bedroom, he puts the knife down on the counter. He reaches into the right-hand pocket of his coat and pulls out a 2-foot-long piece of the trip wire. This will do just fine, Jones thinks to himself, as he reaches into the left-hand pocket and pulls out 2 small wooden handles. Jones then wraps one end of the trip wire around one of the handles. When that is good and tight, he repeats the process with the other handle. Standing outside of Miss Cole's open bedroom door, he watches her sleep. He slowly and quietly walks to the edge of her bed. He very softly rubs her hair. Jones then flicks her on the forehead extremely hard. She immediately sits up in bed, but before she even has a chance to scream, Jones has the wire pulled tight around her neck. He squeezes so hard that the wire begins to cut into her skin. After a few minutes, he releases the handles and lets her body fall to the bed. As casually as he walked in, he walks out and heads back to his apartment. After committing 2 murders in one night, Jones is finally able to get a good night's sleep. The next day, Jones heads into work like nothing ever happened. As he walks past the conference room, Elliot sticks his head out of the door and says, "Jones, get in here." "What's going on?" Jones asks, while doing a brilliant job of acting like he doesn't already know.
"He got to his ex-wife last night," Elliot replies.
"What happened to the protection detail?"
"He slit the poor kid's throat. I don't think Officer Cones even knew what hit him."
"So he killed the officer and then killed his ex-wife?" says Jones.
"He killed Officer Cones. As for Jennifer, she's a tough woman. She's still hanging in there,"
Chief Galloway says. "She's alive? How? I mean, what happened?" Jones asks, as he can feel his heart rate beginning to speed up.
"Barely. To be honest, the life support is the only thing keeping her alive,"
Chief Galloway replies.
"The doctors say she has a 50-50 chance of surviving," Elliot says.
"She knows me. What if she saw my face? I can't let this ruin me. I've worked too hard to build this life. I have to figure out how to finish her off," Jones thinks to himself, while Chief Galloway and Elliot continue talking to him. Jones is so deep into thought that all the voices around him just sound like muffled echoes.
"Jones! Hello, Jones!"
Elliot says as he snaps his fingers right in front of Jones' face.
"Huh, what?"
Jones says, as if he were startled.
"Are you okay, buddy?"
Elliot asks. "No, yeah, I'm fine. I was just thinking of everything that poor woman has been through, and then I started to think about Morstead. I guess I just got lost in thought," Jones replies, as he slowly lowers and shakes his head.
"Do you need some time to get away from here?"
Chief Galloway asks, as he puts his hand on Jones' shoulder.
"Here, as in the office, or do you mean the case?"
Jones asks, as he looks up at Chief.
"I just meant here in the office, unless you think you need some time away from the case, Jones,"
Chief Galloway says.
"No, definitely not. I can't come off this case, Chief. I owe it to Morstead,"
Jones replies, as he shakes his head. "Maybe I just need a little time away from the office. Is it all right with you if I just take the day off to clear my head, Chief?"
"That's fine, Jones. Take all the time you need. Is that okay with you, Agent Roberts?"
Chief Galloway asks.
"It's not a problem at all. We have everything under control. Just get yourself together, Jones. We need you on this case, but we need you at your best,"
says Elliot. "Thanks, guys," Jones says, right before he walks out of the door. On his way to the hospital, Jones stops at a local flower shop.
"How can I help you today, sir?"
the beautiful young lady behind the counter asks.
"I need a bouquet of flowers, Amy,"
Jones replies as he reads her name tag.
"Is it going to be delivery or do you need them now?"
she asks. "Now we'll be fine. I can take them to the hospital myself," he replies.
"It will take me about 15 minutes to get them ready for you, sir. Is that okay?"
"Yes," replies Jones. She gets the flowers ready. Then Jones pays for them, and he makes his way to the hospital. He stops at the nurse's station in the ICU.
"Hello, ma'am. I'm Detective Harry Jones. Can you tell me which room Jennifer Cole is in, please?"
"I sure can, provided you show me your credentials,"
the lady replies.
"Here you go,"
Jones says, as he pulls out his badge and shows it to the woman.
"I'm sorry, Detective. She's under protective custody, so I have to screen anyone that comes in for her."
No, don't be sorry. I'm glad you're doing your job. In fact, I thank you for it."
"She's in room 223. Just continue down the hallway, and when you get to the end, take a right. You will see a uniformed officer sitting outside of her door."
"All right. Thank you very much, ma'am. You have a great day."
Jones walks down the hallway and turns right, like the woman said.
"How is she doing?"
Jones asks the officer posted outside of her room.
She's not doing so well, Jones,
the man replies. I brought her some flowers. Would you mind if I go in and sit with her a minute? Jones asks.
No, not at all. Go right ahead. I'll run down to the cafeteria and get some coffee while you're here,
the officer replies. Jones puts the flowers on the nightstand next to her bed. He notices that someone else has brought some flowers as well. He then reads the card that is sticking out from the top of the flowers. On the very top it says, delivered by Claire's Flower Shop. This is the same local flower shop Jones just left from. Under that, there's a short note that reads,
Jennifer, I'm so sorry this has happened to you. I wish I could be there with you. I still love you and I always will. Tommy.
Jones takes the card and sticks it in his pocket. He then hears the door opening. A doctor holding a clipboard walks in, followed by Elliot.
Jones, what are you doing here?
I just needed to check up on her, replies Jones.
I understand why you're here, Jones, but I need you to realize that Morstead's death and Miss Cole's injuries are not your fault,
Elliot says.
I know,
Jones replies as he lowers his head.
I just feel like if I would have done a little bit more, she wouldn't be lying in this bed. I understand. I really do. But Jones, I need your help with this case. And the only way you can do that is to clear your head and get past this.
I know. I'm all right, Elliot.
If you ever need anyone to talk to, I'm here for you,
Elliot says.
I appreciate the offer, but I'm all right. I'm going home now. I just wanted to stop by real quick, says Jones. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow then.
Jones is driving to his apartment when he suddenly slams his fist into the steering wheel.
How in the hell am I supposed to finish her off without anyone knowing I was there?
He asks himself out loud. Jones is up all night, just lying in his bed, trying to sleep. The pressure is beginning to build up inside of him. With the fact that he may have slipped up big this time, Jones is too close to possibly getting caught, so he decides to not go on another killing spree tonight. Instead, he lays there all night trying to come up with a plan on how he can get to Jennifer Cole without being seen. It's time to get ready for work. His alarm clock goes off, even though he's wide awake and hasn't even come close to falling asleep throughout the night. Tired, scared, and angry at himself for not killing Jennifer Cole when he had the chance, Jones strolls into the police department. Chief Galloway and Elliot are standing at the front lobby.
How are you feeling today, Jones?
Asks Elliot.
I'm good, replies Jones.
I really don't want to be the one that has to tell you the bad news, but Jennifer Cole passed away last night,
Chief Galloway says. Before Jones has a chance to respond, the door leading in from outside suddenly opens. Tom Clover walks through the door. Jones immediately feels his heart drop like a ton of bricks. He pulls his gun and aims it at Tom. As quickly as Jones pulled his gun, Elliot tackles him to the ground. Just the sight of Jones scares the life out of Tom, so he runs right back out of the door. Several officers chase after him. In a matter of minutes, Elliot managed to wrestle the gun away from Jones before he could fire a shot, and the pursuing officers caught Tom Clover within a block of the police department. Jones, Elliot, and Chief Galloway are all three in the chief's office.
Jones, after that outburst, I'm left with no choice but to take you off the case,
Elliot says.
Look, I don't know what I was thinking. I just reacted when I saw him standing there. I wasn't really going to shoot him,
Jones says.
Whether you were or not, you're clearly showing signs of not being mentally capable of handling the pressure of this case. You left me with no choice, and the decision is final,
replies Elliot.
Come on, Chief, you know me. Are you just going to sit there and let him do this?
Jones, I don't have the authority to overrule him on this. And to be completely honest with you, I don't necessarily disagree with him. You pulled your service weapon in the department on an unarmed suspect that killed your best friend. Thank God it happened in the department, or you might have lost your job, let alone this case. Now get out of my office and go home. And damn it, I mean it. Go home and get some rest, Jones.
Chief Galloway shouts. After Jones has left, Elliot and Chief Galloway continue their conversation.
Chief, I'm going to do everything I can to keep this under the table. I like Jones, and I think he's a great asset to your team. I can't begin to imagine everything that's going through his mind right now. So I give you my word. I will do my best to leave it out of my reports. I better get downstairs and start questioning Tom Clover.
Thanks a lot, Agent Roberts. Jones is a good man. He's just going through a lot,
Chief Galloway replies. Elliot enters the interrogation room and sits across the table from Tom Clover.
I'm Special Agent Roberts with the FBI. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Tom nods his head in agreement.
First, I'd like to know if you are in fact Tom Clover.
Yes, I am.
Are you also the drifter that's been hanging around Miss Green's barn?
Yes, sir, I am.
All right, Tom. So where have you been for the last 10 years?
Nowhere, really. Just kind of here and there, and always on the road and always on the move.
What made you decide to come back?
Elliot asks. Tom lets out a deep sigh as he says,
I really can't tell you.
I don't know. I guess I just figured it was time. How did it make you feel when you found out your ex-wife married Mark Cole, the man she was having an affair with?
I don't know. I didn't really think about it much.
Did it make you angry? Elliot asks.
What kind of question is that? How would you feel if one of your best friends were sleeping with your wife? Of course it made me angry.
Tom replies. How angry? Asks Elliot.
What do you mean, how angry? I didn't know there was a scale to judge your anger on.
Well, were you just a little angry where it made you want to wait outside of a bar for him so you could slap him around a few times? Or were you very angry? Like angry enough to put a bullet in his head and everyone else that hurt you as well?
I know you're trying to pin these murders on me. But the truth is, I walked in here on my own, remember? After I heard that Jennifer was killed, I had to come forward and tell the truth about what I know.
And what truth is that? Asks Elliot.
That cop that tried to shoot me when I walked in. He knows the truth.
Why don't you just tell me what's going on? Elliot says.
I'm not going to tell you anything unless you can promise me my safety.
I thought I already showed you that I won't let anyone hurt you by stopping Detective Jones.
So that's the name the devil goes by around here, Tom says.
What exactly do you mean by that?
After I tell you this, you have to promise me that no one from the department will be alone with me.
How about you just tell me what you know, and then we will go from there, Elliot replies.
No, that's not good enough. I need your word.
Elliot can see the fear, the real fear in Tom's eyes. So he agrees and tells him he will have his personal protection until they get to the bottom of everything.
Now that you have my word that nothing will happen to you, tell me what it is you know, Elliot says.
All right, that cop Jones, he's a dirty cop.
What are you talking about? Elliot replies. The day he shot at me behind Miss Green's barn, I heard everything he said right before he shot the other guy. He said that he killed all the other people and that he also killed his own wife and son.
So let me get this right. You're trying to tell me that Jones killed his partner and best friend?
Then what, framed you for it?
Detective Jones saw you shoot his partner in the head.
No, I'm telling you, Tom starts to say before Elliot interrupts him.
I've heard enough of this. I'll come back in a couple of days and see if you're ready to talk then.
You promised you would protect me, Tom says as he slams his hands onto the table.
Well, I also thought you were ready to talk. Have fun. I'll see you in a couple of days, Elliot says as he walks out of the room.
Elliot goes to his office, which the chief temporarily had set up for him. Even though he doesn't believe a word Tom Clover is saying, he makes notes of it in his files. The more he writes and reviews the files, the more he notices things just don't seem to add up. He doesn't know if it's pure curiosity or if, in fact, he's starting to believe Tom Clover. But either way, he calls the head office and asks them to run a full background check on Detective Harry Jones. Chapter 6. The head office tells Elliot that it will take about an hour to run the check. So he decides to talk with the chief about some of the things that are bothering him about the case.
How are you holding up, Chief?
Elliot asks.
Doing all right.
Look, Chief, I have some concerns about the case. First, it was the military-grade tripwire, which I told myself anyone can get their hands on. But the more I think about it, whoever put it there knew exactly what they were doing. Then there was the military knife left at Jennifer Cole's crime scene. Again, that could be coincidence. Then I dug deeper and thought about it harder. Why did Officer Cones have his window down on a cold night? It just seems to me like he knew the person that killed him. I also reviewed photos of his wounds. They were clean, direct, and straight. That leads me to believe that the killer was highly trained.
What are you trying to say?
Chief Galloway asks.
Just stick with it and follow me, Elliot replies.
Okay, I'm listening.
Then when I talked with Tom Clover, he tells me this crazy story, that it was Jones that killed Morstead in the woods. He also said that he heard Jones confess to all of the other murders to Morstead right before he killed him.
That's bullshit. Are you going to stand here and tell me that you believe any of that?
Chief Galloway asks as his voice rises with anger.
I don't know what I believe. In fact, I was pretty upset about the allegations myself at first, but the more I looked at the case, the more everything seemed to be unclear to me. There is one more thing that Tom Clover said that's really sticking in my head.
And what's that?
Chief asks.
Clover said he heard Jones tell Morstead he was the one responsible for killing his own wife and son.
That's just preposterous. Tom Clover knows what he's done, and he doesn't want to spend the rest of his life in prison,
Chief Galloway says.
That's exactly what I thought at first, Chief. But that led me to question how Tom Clover, which has been missing for 10 years, knew anything about Jones or the death of his family.
There's a number of different ways he could have found out. I refuse to believe that Jones had anything to do with those murders,
Chief Galloway says in Jones' defense.
Chief, I'm not trying to spread any allegations, but do you remember what I said in the first briefing I had with everyone? I said if anyone raises a red flag to me, they will be thoroughly investigated.
Yes, I remember that.
Galloway agrees.
Therefore, out of respect, I just wanted to let you know that Jones has risen that red flag, and I've already started my investigation on him. I would appreciate it if you don't tell him anything about this conversation until my investigation is through,
Elliot tells the chief.
All right, fine, but I want to go on record right now and tell you that I don't like this one bit,
says Chief Galloway.
I don't like it either, Chief, but I have a job to do, and I'm just trying to do it.
His phone begins to ring.
This is Agent Roberts. Go ahead.
Agent Roberts, this is Samantha Blackwell at Quantico. I have the information you requested on Detective Harry Jones.
Already? Well, that was fast. Did you run a complete history on him?
Elliot asks.
Yes, sir, I did, but there wasn't much to find.
What do you mean?
Elliot asks.
Well, his history only goes back about 3 months before he got married to his late wife. To be honest, until then, Harry Jones didn't exist,
Blackwell says.
Will you fax me the paperwork?
Elliot asks.
I sure will. I'll do it right now.
Thank you. I'll get back to you if I need anything else,
Elliot says, right before he hangs up the phone. He then heads back to Chief Galloway's office.
How much do you know about Jones, Chief?
What do you mean?
Chief Galloway replies.
Well, even with all the technology the FBI has these days, it seems that Harry Jones just appears out of nowhere 3 months before he married his wife. So who is he? Or should I say, who was he before then?
Elliot asks.
Chief, I have some work to do, and I need to figure out what's going on around here. But remember, all of this information stays in your office. This isn't a threat, but if you ever want to see that retirement dream of yours come true, you better make damn sure it doesn't leave your office,
Elliot says before he walks out of the room. Elliot goes back to his desk and gets to work on trying to uncover who Jones really is. He looks in the notes that he has from the one-on-one interview he had with Jones.
There it is, Green Lake, Minnesota,
Elliot says to himself. Green Lake is the town that Jones said he grew up in. Elliot does a quick search on the internet to find out where Green Lake is located. Just as he was expecting, it's only about 30 minutes away from Greenland. Elliot makes the short drive from Greenland to Green Lake. It's a small town and seems to be really quiet. Elliot wants to hit some of the local shops and show Jones' picture around in hopes that someone will recognize him. After going to almost every shop on the main street, Elliot hasn't had any luck. Right before he heads out of town, he stops at a gas station to grab something to drink and fills his SUV up with gas.
I might as well bring the picture in and try my luck again, he thinks to himself.
Hello there, young man. Can I help you find something?
The little old lady from behind the counter says to Elliot as he walks in the store.
No, thank you, ma'am. I'm just going to get some gas and something to drink real quick. But if you don't mind, would you take a look at this photograph I have and let me know if you recognize this man?
I don't mind at all. Just let me get my glasses.
She puts on her glasses, and Elliot hands her the photo.
Why, I know exactly who this is,
she says, after a quick glance at the photo.
Do you know his name?
Elliot asks.
Of course I know his name. He's my son, although his legal name and the name I gave him at birth are different now.
So this man right here is your son?
Elliot says, as he points to the picture.
Yes, he is. His birth name is Alfred Knox, but his legal name is now Harry Jones. He gets aggravated with me, but I still call him Alfred every time I see him. You do know he's a detective in the next town over,
she says.
My name is Special Agent Roberts. I'm with the FBI, ma'am. Well, my name is Martha Knox. It's very nice to meet you, young man. Although I must ask you why the FBI is interested in my son.
I was working with him on a case, but I haven't seen him in a couple of days. So I was just checking to see if he was all right.
When was the last time you've seen your son?
Elliot asks.
It's been a few months now. He used to come by a lot more, but last time he came, he told me he was going to be really busy at work for a while, so it might be some time before he could make it back. Miss Knox, I have to ask, do you know why your son changed his name?
After he accidentally shot his father, everyone looked at him differently. So he and I both decided it would be good for him to get a fresh start with a new name. Then he decided he was going to join the military. That way he didn't have to change his name and nobody would know who he was. I was so proud of him. He found a new start where he could build a whole new life. Then, after the military didn't work out, he changed his name. Now my boy is Detective Harry Jones. I'm so proud of him.
All right, well, thank you, ma'am. Oh, and will you do me a favor? If you happen to see him, don't tell him I came looking for him, please. All he would do is tease me about it. So if you could just keep this conversation between us.
Miss Knox begins to laugh.
That sounds just like my boy. But all right, your secret is safe with me. You have yourself a good day now.
Yes, ma'am. You do the same.
As Elliot heads back to Greenland, he calls Agent Rockwell at Quantico to see what she can find on Alfred Knox. Elliot makes it back to the Greenland Police Department. he decides not to talk to Chief Galloway about the new information that he found on Jones. So he goes straight to his office and waits for Rockwell to call him back. After waiting another 15 minutes, she finally calls him back.
I have the information you requested, Agent Roberts.
It took you a lot longer this time, he says.
That's because there was a lot more to find. Actually, I'm just going to fax everything over that I found on Mr. Knox and let you go over it yourself if that's okay with you,
she replies.
That will be fine. I'm at my desk now and thank you again,
Elliot says right before he hangs up. Elliot has a very large stack of papers after the fax machine finally stops printing. It seems that Alfred Knox has a completely different history than that of Detective Jones. Elliot now has his entire life on paper. Military records, medical reports, school transcripts, bank statements, and credit card history. Everything you can imagine. It's time to see who Jones really is, Elliot thinks to himself as he gets started on digging through the paperwork. Jones was in and out of trouble often during his childhood. He was even expelled from school one year. However, it's the military records that really catch Elliot's eye the most. His record shows that he was an excellent marksman with a number of different awards. He showed great promise in his young military career until he was kicked out suddenly. The military records read, medically discharged due to the fact that Knox is emotionally and mentally unstable. It is the recommendation of the U.S. Army that Knox seeks professional help from a psychologist or qualified medical professional immediately after being discharged. Elliot quickly realizes that Jones has a lot more to hide than just his name. He finds himself wondering if Jones or Knox ever did in fact seek the medical help he needed. So he goes through every page of Knox's medical history. After reading every medical page, it seems to Elliot that Jones never did follow up on the Army's recommendations. After compiling all the data he found in the files on Knox, Elliot is extremely worried for the safety of Jones and anyone around him. It seems that Jones has a number of personality traits that make up a serial killer. The lack of a steady relationship, anger issues, trouble dealing with authority figures, unable to manage bills and maintain a structured home life. The emotional and mental instability that the Army mentioned are all classic signs. Instead of bringing this information to the chief, Elliot decides to see what Jones has to say about all of this. After all, he does like Jones, and there's still a small part of him that doesn't believe Jones is capable of committing these crimes.
Hey, Chief, have you seen Jones around today?
Elliot asks.
No, I haven't seen him today. Why? What's up?
Chief replies.
Oh, nothing. There's just a few things I wanted to go over with him about the case, that's all.
Okay. Well, I will tell him that you are looking for him when I see him.
All right, thanks, Chief,
Elliot replies. Elliot asks a few more people around the department with the same results. Nobody has seen Jones today. He then decides he will just head over to Jones' apartment to check on him. When Elliot reaches the door to Jones' apartment, he realizes it's slightly cracked open. Elliot knocks on the door and opens it even further.
Jones, are you in there? It's Elliot.
He knocks again, and this time pushes the door open wide.
Hey, Jones. Are you in there? Is everything all right?
Jones doesn't answer. Elliot slowly and cautiously enters the apartment with his gun in hand.
Jones, it's Elliot. I'm coming in. I need to know if you're okay.
Elliot continues into the open area, which looks to be Jones' living room. He then goes down a very small hallway. The open door on the right is the bathroom. It's a very small bathroom, and other than behind the shower curtain, which Jones doesn't have, there would be nowhere for anyone to hide. At the end of the hall, there's a small door. Elliot opens it. It's just an empty linen closet, other than a handful of towels that occupy one of the three shelves. To the left of the linen closet, there is one more door. Elliot slowly turns the handle and pushes the door open. It's Jones' bedroom.
Are you in there, Jones?
Still no answer. So Elliot slowly enters the bedroom. He sees a black duffel bag lying on the edge of the bed, with a piece of paper next to it. As he is making his way closer to the bed, Elliot suddenly hears movement behind him, and the bedroom door slams shut. Before he's able to completely turn around, he feels an agonizing burning sensation on the back of his head. Suddenly, Elliot is overcome with a feeling of dizziness. His vision begins to blur, and his balance is lost. Elliot falls hard on the floor. With the room spinning and his eyes not working properly, he reaches for the back of his head. Elliot feels the warm, wet liquid that is protruding from his head. He pulls his hand back in front of his face to try and look at the substance, but everything is just a blur. Although Elliot is fairly confident that the substance is indeed blood, he doesn't know how or why he's bleeding. In fact, at this moment, all he really knows is that he is on the verge of passing out. He somehow finds the strength to gather himself to his knees. From there, he uses the bed and tries to force himself to his feet. Elliot is on his feet, but not for long. with the room seeming to spin faster than cars going around a racetrack. He is far too disoriented to stand on his own and falls again. This time, he was unable to break his fall. His head smashes into the floor. Elliot is out cold. Chapter 7. When Elliot regains consciousness, although he suffers from an extreme headache, his vision is somewhat restored. He looks at his hand, and the now dried substance is in fact blood. Elliot sits up and leans his back against the bed. He notices a pipe lying on the floor next to him. Still a little disoriented, but now able to stand on his own 2 feet, he stands up and tries to regain his composure. Then he discovers that the duffel bag is gone, and the piece of paper is now littered with words. The piece of paper reads, "Elliot, it was so nice of you to drop by, although you should have called first. Sorry about your head. You did catch me off guard. I figured it wouldn't be long before Tom Clover ran his mouth and that you would put all the pieces together and then come looking for me. Wow, I must say, you sure are one tough SOB. I've killed a man that I didn't hit as hard as I hit you. I was in awe after you took that shot to the head and still had enough strength to almost stand back up. After witnessing that firsthand, I couldn't let you just bleed to death. Oh no, that would have been far too easy and not nearly enough fun. So I took the liberty of patching you up. I only have one last thing to say. Be sure to look on the outside of my bedroom door. I left a surprise for you. I truly hope your day gets better, Elliot. Signed, A.K. Elliot slowly opens the bedroom door, where he finds his gun and flashlight hanging from some more tripwires on the doorknob. Elliot immediately calls Chief Galloway, and within the hour, Jones' apartment is crawling with police. Elliot now realizes that it's time to fill Chief Galloway in on everything he has learned about Jones.
I just can't believe this is happening. I've never been more wrong about anything in my life,
Chief Galloway says as he runs both his hands through his hair.
Chief, it's an honest mistake. I'm specially trained for situations just like this, and I didn't even see this one coming,
Elliot says as he tries to settle Chief Galloway down.
I'm telling you right now, if I hadn't lost 2 officers on this case already, I would hang my hat up and put in for early retirement. It just doesn't make any sense. I really thought I knew the guy,
Chief Galloway says.
You do know him. You just know him as Detective Jones, not Alfred Knox. Chief, I need you to think really hard. Where would Jones go to next?
Elliot asks.
I don't know. I mean the only 2 people left on the original list is yourself and I. God, no!
What is it, Chief?
Elliot asks.
Tom, Jones, set this whole thing up. He knew you would call it in, and he also knew that everyone would be here,
Chief Galloway replies.
So that leaves Tom Clover defenseless, and Jones knows exactly where he is,
Elliot says, as both men rush out the door. Chief Galloway and Elliot both drive as fast as they can to the police department. Chief Galloway arrives moments before Elliot. They swing open the door and run inside.
Has anyone been in here?
Chief Galloway shouts to the girl sitting at the dispatch counter, caught off guard and startled.
No, no, sir,
she answers before she even thinks about the question.
Wait, yes, Detective Jones came in a few minutes ago. What's going on, Chief Galloway?
The girl asks as she stands up from the chair she was sitting in.
Get on the radio and tell all units to report here immediately,
Chief shouts. Elliot and Chief Galloway cautiously make their way to the holding cells. When they unlock the door and enter the big room which houses the 10 individual cells, they hear Tom Clover screaming for help.
Agent Roberts, you have to help me. You gave me your word. It's him. He was just here.
Are you okay? Did he hurt you?
Elliot asks.
No, I'm fine. I'm really scared, though,
Tom replies.
He told me to tell you the game is on and to watch your back, because from here on out, he won't give you any more free passes.
How long ago was it that he was here?
Chief Galloway asks.
I'm not sure. I would say 15 minutes ago. Please, Agent Roberts, don't let him get to me,
Tom cries out.
Is there any other way out of here?
Elliot asks the chief.
Just the back door. It leads to the alley behind the police station.
Lead the way. Hurry, he's getting away,
Elliot shouts. The 2 men search the alley and the surrounding area, but they find no trace of Jones. They circle back around the building. They are now standing on the steps in front of the police department. Elliot and Chief Galloway are discussing different tactics on how to find Jones. They have no idea that he's only 100 yards away, on the rooftop of an abandoned building.
Eeny, meeny, miny, moe,
Jones says to himself, as he moves the crosshairs of his high-powered scope from Elliot's head, back to Chief Galloway's. Catch a tiger by his toe. If he hollers, let him go. Jones squeezes the trigger. Elliot hears the shot. but it's humanly impossible to react faster than a speeding bullet. All Elliot can do is stand there and watch in what seems to be slow motion as the bullet explodes from the back of Chief Galloway's head. As Chief Galloway's body collapses, Elliot dives headfirst over the short brick wall that provides railing for the steps. He crashes into the bushes below, which actually breaks his fall instead of any bones. Elliot rolls off the bushes and lies on the ground, behind them, as flat and motionless as he can.
"We'll be seeing each other again soon, Elliot!"
Jones shouts from the rooftop, as he fires a warning shot into the side of the building, just a mere 5 feet above where Elliot is laying. Every ounce of Elliot's drive and determination is telling him to get up and go after Jones. Elliot doesn't move. He's frozen with fear. Not fear of Jones himself, but fear of what he is capable of. After being on the ground frozen in time for 10 minutes, which to Elliot seemed like an eternity, he quickly crawls to the edge of the building. When he reaches it, he jumps up and sprints as fast as he can down the narrow alleyway towards the back of the police department. Elliot grabs his phone, but before he makes the call, he stares at it in his hand. Although he hates to admit it, it appears that Jones has outclassed him, outsmarted him, and clearly has much more tactical training than he had anticipated. To put it simply, Jones is just better at killing than Elliot is at catching killers. Elliot knows that in order for him to stop Jones, he must call Quantico and get some help here immediately. Just as he hits send to make the call, Elliot can't believe his eyes. He hits the end button before it has a chance to ring. Elliot sees Jones step out from behind one of the other buildings in the alley. Jones has his back turned to him, walking in the opposite direction.
"Did he see me? No, it's too dark. There's no way he could have seen me,"
Elliot thinks to himself. Can this really be happening? Has Elliot accidentally and purely by coincidence just stumbled upon Jones' escape route? Or is this just another one of Jones' highly intelligent plans? Chapter 8. Elliot decides to follow Jones. He doesn't want to gain any distance on Jones, so he slowly and carefully matches Jones step for step while making sure he keeps him in his sights. Jones is about 50 feet ahead of him in the mostly dark alleyways. There is the occasional dim light on the back or side of one of the buildings, which puts out a radius of light equal to about 10 feet, so Elliot can easily maneuver around him to stay hidden in the darkness. For a split second, he thinks about just pulling his gun and either shooting Jones in the back or announcing his presence, forcing Jones to give himself up. However, that thought doesn't last long. Jones is way too smart. Surely this is all part of his plan. And if it's not, then Elliot is willing to bet his life on the fact that Jones would have a plan B lined up. That's a bet Elliot is not willing to take, so he decides to keep following Jones and wait for the perfect opportunity to surprise him. The element of surprise is a huge advantage to have in your favor. History has proven time and again that in almost any situation, the one whom has surprise usually reigns victorious. The alleyway eventually comes to an end, at a small walking path that leads into the woods. After Jones makes his way onto the path and into the woods, Elliot hangs back in the alleyway for a few seconds. He doesn't want to be close enough that Jones can hear him walking on the pathway. Elliot continues to follow Jones in an almost ninja-like fashion, when suddenly Jones stops. So Elliot quickly and quietly ducks down into the woods. From his position, he's able to keep an eye on Jones. He sees Jones step into the opposite side of the woods from the pathway that he is on. After waiting another 30 seconds, Elliot starts to stand up and head in that direction. Then suddenly, Jones steps out of the woods and back onto the pathway. Jones is still holding the rifle in his right hand, but now he is carrying a duffel bag in his left hand. He drops the bag and sits down next to it. Jones then begins to disassemble the rifle while placing the individual parts into the bag. When he's done, he grabs the bag, stands up, and starts to continue down the pathway.
"This is it. This is my chance. He's unarmed. Surely this can't be part of his plan,"
Elliot begins to realize. Without another moment's hesitation, Elliot jumps from the woods with his gun in his hand.
"Jones, it's all over. Don't move. If you even think about moving, I will shoot you where you stand,"
Elliot shouts out loud as he sprints towards Jones, now only standing 5 feet behind Jones.
"Drop the bag and slowly interlock your fingers behind your head," Elliot orders Jones at gunpoint.
Jones does exactly as he is told.
"Good. Now I want you to slowly drop down to your right knee and then very slowly follow it by placing your left knee in the dirt."
Again, Jones does exactly as he is told.
"Okay, now cross your left ankle over your right one and do not make any sudden movements,"
Elliot says as he inches forward. Elliot no longer has the element of surprise, but with Jones in this position, he now has a new element to work with, the advantage of leverage. So even if Jones does make a move, chances are that Elliot will be able to overpower him with little effort. Although it was a very wise decision to make on Elliot's part, the action wasn't needed. Jones offers Elliot no resistance at all. In fact, the only thing he says or does is, "Good job, Elliot. I'm proud of you. I knew you could do it." Elliot leads Jones with his hands cuffed behind his back, straight back down the pathway from whence they came. When they make it back to the police department, Elliot notices a huge crowd of reporters and some of the town's civilians which have accumulated in front of the building. "That didn't take long for the vultures to get here, did it?" Jones says, with that now irritating grin back on his face.
"Just shut up, Jones. You've killed two cops already, and now you kill the chief of police. What exactly did you expect to happen?"
Elliot says out of pure anger. "What did I expect? It doesn't really matter anymore now, does it?" Jones replies, as he tilts his head and exposes his teeth with a full-blown smile.
"Oh, do tell. I have to hear it. I just can't wait to hear what the genius that constructed this whole twisted operation had in mind."
Elliot sarcastically snaps back. "Fine. If you must know, I planned on being somewhere eating a bowl of popcorn, watching all of these idiots crying over the chief on the news."
"You're sick, Jones,"
is all Elliot can say in response to that. As Elliot walks Jones from out of the alley, he takes his blazer off and drapes it over Jones' head. They are suddenly swarmed with reporters, questions, and flashes of their cameras.
"Hey, excuse me, is this the Saw Killer?"
one young reporter shouts, as he sticks a microphone in Elliot's face. He doesn't answer. He just keeps moving. The only thing he can think is that this reporter looks like he should still be in high school, not questioning him.
"Are you the FBI agent that's been sent here to capture the killer?"
Elliot hears another reporter shout.
"Come on, man, give us something. The public just wants to know if the killer's been brought to justice or not,"
the young teenage boy-looking reporter says. Elliot stops, then turns and faces the crowd.
"My name is Special Agent Roberts with the FBI. And yes, the public is safe as far as the Saw Killer is concerned. We believe we now have the right person responsible for the murders in custody."
"What's his name?"
"How did you catch him?"
"Did he say why he did it?
Would he like to make a statement?"
The questions just start pouring out from the crowd.
"I'm not answering any more questions at this time. I will make an official statement after I've gathered all the facts surrounding the case. That's all I have to say for now,"
Elliot says, as he turns back around and walks away. Elliot stops at the first cop he comes to.
"No one is to speak to the press under any circumstances. Do you hear me?"
he whispers in the cop's ear. The young street cop nods his head. After Elliot locks Jones in the holding cell, he calls Altus and has him come to the lab immediately. When Altus arrives, Elliot hands him the duffel bag as he says,
"I need the contents of this bag tested against any evidence we may have found at the crime scenes of all the murders."
"Where did you get the bag from?"
Altus asks.
"I took it from the killer," replies Elliot.
"What? Did you catch him?"
"Yes, I did. He's in the holding cell."
"Well, who is it?"
Altus asks frantically.
"Just run the test for me, please. I need the result as soon as possible. The killer's true identity will be released soon enough,"
Elliot says. While waiting on the results from Altus, Elliot pulls a few old reports that were filed by Jones. Then he faxes the reports, along with both of the letters the killer left for him, to the handwriting expert at the FBI. Next, he calls this expert on the phone.
"What's up, Chester? This is Agent Roberts."
"Hey, Roberts, what can I do for you today?"
"I faxed you a few documents. If you don't mind, I need you to compare them as soon as possible. This could be very vital information to my case,"
Elliot says.
"Not a problem. I'll check it out right now." "Yep, here they are. I'll go ahead and examine these for you right now. I'll call you back with the results as soon as I'm finished."
"Thanks a lot, Chester. I'll be waiting."
Chester is known as the FBI's best handwriting analyst and one of the best in the world. He's extremely good and fast at what he does. Within 15 minutes, he calls Elliot back.
"Hello, this is Agent Roberts speaking."
"Hey, Roberts, it's Chester. I have those results for you."
"So what was the conclusion of your test results? Were all of the documents written by the same person?"
"After running the analysis, I am 99.9% sure that every one of those documents were indeed written by the same hand,"
Chester says.
"That's great news. Thanks a lot, Chester,"
Elliot says, before he hangs up the phone. Elliot spends another hour going through the case files, then decides to check back with Altus to see if he has any results.
"Do you have anything yet?"
Elliot asks Altus.
"Actually, you have perfect timing. I just got finished with my analysis."
"So what did you determine?"
Elliot asks.
"In my professional opinion, I would be willing to testify in court that this gun is in fact the weapon used to fire bullets that killed our victims."
"Thanks. Good work, Altus,"
Elliot replies.
"Not a problem. I'm just stating the scientific facts."
With all of the physical evidence matching to Jones, Elliot now has rock-solid proof that Jones is the Saw Killer. Elliot now decides that it's time to have a few words with Jones face-to-face. Chapter 9.
There's just one thing I have to know. Why did you do it, Jones?
Elliot asks. After a long pause, Jones finally answers. I guess it all started with my father. He was a very controlling and mentally abusive person. Finally, one day when I was 16 years old, we were in the woods hunting and I could just feel it building up inside of me. I knew I just had enough of him. So I pointed my gun at him and lined his head up in my scope. Then I squeezed the trigger. I had never felt anything that exhilarating in my life, Jones says.
So how is it that you were never charged with his murder?
Elliot asks. Of course they brought me in for questioning, but I made up this crazy story about how we were walking through the woods and I tripped, fell, and my gun went off. As I'm sure you've noticed, I am pretty good at hiding the truth.
What happened then? Asks Elliot.
Well, after that, I still had the urge to kill, so I decided to join the military, which was going really well until they kicked me out, I might add. I met my wife, a few years went by, we had a son, and everything was under control. No urges, everything was good.
What changed that?
Elliot asks. She started digging around and found out I'd changed my name, and she started asking too many questions about it. Then she had the nerve to ask me if I killed my father on purpose. Needless to say, we got into a huge fight. I left and went to the bar, and when I came back home, the urges came back with me. I couldn't let this bitch stop me, could I? Oh no, I couldn't do that. So I had to kill her. That way no one would ever find out about my past, replies Jones.
You killed your own wife and child?
Elliot asks in pure disgust. Yes, I did. And then everything was fine. The urges were gone again, so I became a police officer.
What happened to trigger the next attack? Elliot asks.
Ha! Mike Lear in his damn mouth, that's what happened. We were drinking at the bar, and after we left, we got into an argument, Jones says. Knowing what I'm capable of doing, I couldn't let that slide, so I killed that worthless drunk. It seemed like it got worse after every kill. The urges just built up more and more inside of me until finally, I just lost control and I couldn't fight them anymore. So that's why I did it. I had to do it, Jones proclaims.
Then why didn't you kill me that night outside of my hotel room when you had the chance?
Elliot asks. I didn't feel the urge to kill you. In fact, I feel like you and I are a lot alike. I knew if anyone could understand me, it would be you.
Okay, so basically you're telling me that you got addicted to the feeling of killing. That's what created your urges, which turned into a burning desire to kill again and again, and you weren't man enough to fight those urges or to seek help,
Elliot says as he stands up.
That's exactly right, Elliot. I have all the information I need. I'm done here. By the way, it's Agent Roberts to you, and you are nothing like me. You're a coward,
Elliot says as he moves towards the door. That truly hurts, Elliot, and to think after all I've done for you. I was beginning to think we were becoming the best of friends. I did, after all, save your life on 3 separate occasions, Jones says.
You didn't save my life. You just didn't take it when you had the chance. And now your little game is over. I win, while you get to rot in jail for the rest of your life. We were never friends, and we will never be, replies Elliot.
You better be careful what you wish for, Jones says, as he waves his finger from side to side in the air.
I'm done with you, Jones, but look on the bright side. I'm sure you'll make a lot of new friends in prison that would love to help keep you warm at night,
Elliot says, as he walks out of the door and slams it shut behind him. The first day of court, Jones has another game to play. He pleads not guilty. Elliot doesn't know if Jones is just trying to buy more time for some other part of his plan, or if Jones is just simply trying to get under his skin by making him stay around longer until the trial is ended. Either way, there's no way Jones can beat this case in court, so the outcome of the trial is not a worry on his mind. With the recorded confession, the testimonies of Chester and Altus, along with the testimony of Tom Clover and that of FBI Special Agent Elliot Roberts, the trial is over quickly. By a jury of his peers, Jones is found guilty on all 6 counts of homicide. He is sentenced to 3 consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. When the judge slams his gavel, everyone in the courtroom begins to clap, including Elliot, as he stares Jones in the eyes. Jones doesn't say a word. All he does is nod his head, with that damn crooked grin on his face. Outside of the courtroom, Elliot is once again swarmed with reporters. Within the crowd, he sees a familiar face. It's the young teenage-looking reporter.
Agent Roberts, Justin Burns here with Action 5 News in Greenland. How does it feel to bring such a high-profile killer to justice?
Well, Justin, it's a wonderful feeling to bring any criminal to justice. I do have to say, though, this one does top the list.
Harry Jones is a deranged psychopath that would have killed over and over again, leaving a long trail of pain and heartache to the families of those potential victims. I'm just thankful for being part of bringing him to justice. Not just for the potential victims whose lives we may have saved, but also for those who have lost their lives and their families right here in Greenland, Elliot replies. On the transport bus to the maximum security prison, Maple Heights, Jones quickly finds out that some of the other incarcerated men aren't too keen on the idea that he is an ex-cop.
Sarge, can you crack a window back here? It's getting really hot and the cop you got in here is starting to sweat. All we can smell is bacon.
One man from the back of the bus shouts.
Yeah, and it's making me sick to my stomach because I'm a vegetarian.
The small Latino man sitting in the row behind Jones says as everyone, including the guards, begin to laugh. Jones is sitting directly behind the driver, separated by a thick metal cage. The driver leans his head back in Jones' direction and says,
Looks like you're not going to have a problem making friends after all, cop killer.
As the transportation vehicle comes to a stop at the main gate in front of the penitentiary, Jones notices the high level of security. The entire structure is surrounded by a set of two razor wire fences, the inner layer of which is a 10-foot-high chain-link fence, topped off with spiraling rows of extremely sharp razors. The second fence is exactly the same, except that it is 5 feet taller in height. The two fences are separated by a 15-foot gap and run parallel to each other all the way around the prison. There are 20-foot guard towers on every corner, which occupy at least two guards at all times. It's obvious that this prison was built to contain the worst criminals in the world. The only thing that would make it more secure is if it were on its own island. The driver pushes the button on the intercom at the gate. It buzzes and the first gate opens. The driver slowly pulls forward to the next gate. When he pushes the button on this intercom, the first gate closes. Then again, the intercom buzzes and the second gate opens. The driver slowly pulls the vehicle down a concrete ramp which leads to a large metal bay door and yet another intercom. The intercom process is repeated and the bay door slowly rolls up. The driver pulls forward and the door closes behind the bus. The room is surrounded by concrete except for the bay door and a metal door with a small, thick plexiglass window. With all of the inmates still on the bus, shackled to a metal ring welded to the floor, the guards open the back door of the bus and one by one unload the prisoners. After each prisoner is unloaded, he is then shackled to the one in front of him. After all of the prisoners have been unloaded, the guard leads them to the metal door. The driver of the bus swipes his key card. The door buzzes and then unlocks. The guards lead the prisoners down a cinder block hallway to the processing center. After processing is finished, each of the new inmates have received one toothbrush, one small tube of prison-issued toothpaste, one mat, one blanket, two towers, a prison identification number, and one blue prison jumpsuit. The guards then assign each of the inmates a cell block and cell number. Jones is assigned to cell block D, cell number 327, which is located on the third tier. The Latino vegetarian is the only other new inmate that has been assigned to cell block D. One of the guards escorts Jones and the other man to the main door of the cell block. The guard buzzes the door and then says,
Welcome home. Step inside.
Both men do as they are told without hesitation.
You girls play nice,
the guard says as he slams the door behind them. Neither man exchanges a single word to one another. Instead, they each head to their assigned cells. Jones finally reaches cell number 327 after climbing three flights of metal stairs. When Jones steps into the cell, he can't help but notice a very large black man laying on the bottom bunk. The man stands up and says,
Hey there, cupcake.
At 6'2", Jones isn't the normal cupcake, but next to this man, anyone would be a cupcake in his eyes. Jones quickly sizes up the man. He estimates him to be 6'10", and judging by the small mountains bulging out of his body where normally muscles should be, he figures the man weighs at least 345 pounds of solid muscle.
Sugar, sugar, sugar. I can't wait for tonight,
the man says as he rubs his large hands together.
Oh, what the hell. I guess now's as good a time as any to make a statement,
Jones thinks to himself. Jones throws his mat and his other belongings on the top bunk. He then turns and faces the man. Faster than a blink of an eye, he violently thrusts the palm of his right hand into the tip of the large man's nose. The man collapses and lies dead on the floor. Unknowingly, Jones just took out the prison's kingpin with his bare hands and instantly took over his place. It turns out the man was Jonathan Rogers. He was originally sentenced to 2 years on a simple burglary charge. But after a fight with three guards and two other inmates turned deadly, he was charged with the murders of all five men. Rogers was sentenced to life in prison. After Jones took him down with such ease, no one will dare stand against him now. Chapter 10. It has been nearly 5 years since Jones was captured and sent to prison. although it is just about impossible to forget the events that took place in the small town of Greenland, Minnesota. The majority of the people in town have managed to move on with their lives. Big John and Little John still have their moving truck company and have also recently opened up their own gun shop. With Little John's criminal record, he pretty much handles the moving truck company on his own nowadays, while his uncle runs the gun shop. Morstead's wife, Susan, still receives letters from Jones on a monthly basis, which she always returns to sender unopened. It has been a rough road for Susan, raising her son alone for the past 5 years, but they're making it just fine. Altus still runs the CSI lab. As for Elliot, he has been extremely busy. After capturing a serial killer, he has become one of the FBI's most highly profiled agents. He has pulled cases from all over the country, Florida, California, Louisiana, and even spent a few weeks in Arkansas solving a kidnapping case. Life has been really good for Elliot since capturing Jones. He finds himself having a lot more time to spend with his wife and son, who is now 7 years old. He is the very spark that gives Elliot meaning in life. Jones has been quite busy in prison. He has killed 3 men within the 5 years he has been in prison. Jonathan Rogers, then the Latino man that was on the bus with him, and some new fish that didn't quite know the ropes yet. He has also written and self-published 2 novels. The first was A Killer in My Eyes. It only sold a grand total of 25 copies. However, the second book he wrote, Haunted Echoes, A Killer's Nightmare, landed Jones a spot on the New York Times bestsellers list. So now on top of being the kingpin, Jones is also the prison's local celebrity. Jones has actually made a lot of friends in prison, and not in a way that's bad for him. Thanks to a couple of dirty guards that are now on his payroll, Jones can get anything in or out of the prison that he wants. The most important person Jones has under his wing is a nerdy computer hacker named Kenneth Turnbow. He hacked one too many computers and landed himself in a spot right smack dab in the middle of cell block D. When Jones finally got word of what Kenneth was in prison for, he quickly scooped him up and offered him his personal protection. Jones knows that a man doing federal time for computer hacking must be really good at what he does. He also knows that a man like that could be very vital to his plan. Kenneth Turnbow is set to be released today. He's getting early parole for good behavior.
So sad you're leaving me, Kenny. Although I do need your help on the outside. Well, more like, I want your help. I don't really need it. You could be very easily replaced. Speaking of that, I sure hope you don't forget our agreement. It would be a tragedy to hear that something happened to you, Kenny, Jones says, as he lightly pats Kenneth on his cheeks.
Oh, no, sir. I won't dare forget about that. You've been so good to me. I owe you my life, replies Kenneth.
Good. Now remember, hack into the FBI system, get me the address, and then wait until the time is right, Jones says.
I remember the plan. I know what to do, sir,
says Kenneth. Do not screw this up. Do I make myself clear? Jones shouts as he grabs Kenneth by both shoulders.
I won't. You have my word. I promise you. I can do this. Just let me prove it to you, sir.
Kenneth replies in fear.
Very good.
I believe you. Go ahead now. Get out of here and go home, Jones replies.
Nearly another 5 years have passed. Elliot is still with the FBI, but he is no longer a field agent. He now spends most of his days sitting behind a desk, working on the computer. This means he now has a more structured schedule. He works 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., and then goes home and spends time with his family. He gets to go to all of Elliot Jr.'s, who is now 12, football games. Elliot Jr. has become quite the little star player. He has even had a picture of his most recent game-winning touchdown in the newspaper. Elliot couldn't be more proud of his son, even if he wanted to be. Meanwhile, back at the prison, Jones, instead of writing more novels, has been educating himself very well with the ample selection of books found in the prison library.
Here's that newspaper you asked for,
the guard says, as he slips it into Jones' cell.
Oh my, my, look at what we have here, Jones says, as he turns to the sports page and sees Elliot Jr.'s game-winning touchdown.
He cuts the picture out, then folds it up and puts it under his mat and begins to write a letter. Chapter 11. 4 days later, Elliot comes home from work. He puts his keys on the key hook and grabs a bottle of water out of the refrigerator.
Hey, Junior, how was school today? Elliot asks his son.
It was pretty good. Nothing really exciting other than the mystery meet we had for lunch,
Junior replies, as both of them laugh out loud.
Oh, yeah. Dad, a letter came in the mail for you today. I put it on the end table in the living room next to your chair.
Thanks, son,
Elliot replies, as he heads for the living room. Elliot sits in his chair and reclines it back. He then reaches over and grabs the letter.
Hello, Elliot. It has been a very long time since we last had the opportunity to speak to one another. I hope life is treating you well. As for myself,
I'm doing pretty well. It seems that I have another hidden talent. The money I made from my best-selling novel really opened a lot of doors for me. I've also come across a lot of very interesting people during my stay in prison. For the past 5 years, I've just been educating myself. Elliot, you would really be surprised of how educated one can truly become while incarcerated. The endless possibility of educational material found in a prison library is very much remarkable. There were, however, a few books that I was unable to find in the library. But like I stated before, the money I've made opened a lot of doors. I recently read a book that taught me how to build bombs out of normal household materials. Oh my, my, look at me ramble on. I wouldn't want to spoil the surprise now, would I? Elliot, do you realize how long I've been incarcerated? Now, don't worry yourself. I haven't been that out of touch with the real world. I recently saw a wonderful picture of your son's game-winning touchdown. Oh, and please tell your wife I absolutely love the way she cut her hair. Well, it's been really nice chatting with you, Elliot, but it's almost chow time and we're having meatloaf, my favorite. I do have a little riddle for you before I go, though. How long was Tom Clover missing before he mysteriously reappeared and allegedly started killing people? That's right, and today marks the 10th year anniversary of what? Game still on. Hope to see you soon. Signed, AK. The letter reads. Elliot scrambles to get out of his chair as fast as possible. Sharon! Sharon! He shouts in search of his wife.
What? I'm right here in the kitchen!
She replies, with a slight attitude-like tone to her voice.
I need you and Elliot Jr. to go to your sister's house in Rhode Island immediately!
My sister's? For what?
Look, I really don't have time to explain right now. I have to go to Minnesota. Just trust me, and do it, please.
Elliot pleads. By the tone of his voice, she knows he's very serious and starts packing immediately. Elliot makes a call to his office and convinces his boss that he needs emergency air transportation to Minnesota. While Elliot's plane is en route, Jones' plan begins to take effect. Just as Jones had planned, at exactly 5 p.m., the entire prison, except for cell block D, breaks out in a riot. Over the last 10 years, there have been several riots that have taken place. During these riots, Jones sat back and observed the guards' reactions, which is a key factor in his plan. When a riot breaks out, all guards are to immediately report to the riot station, where they then suit up and prepare for battle. This process usually takes about 10 minutes. With the size of the riot that is taking place now, Jones has estimated that he has at least an extra 5 minutes. He watches out of his narrow cell window as the guard in the guard tower report inside for riot duty, where they will remain with all the other guards until the situation is under control. This is another vital part of Jones' plan that buys him at least another 2 hours. After the riot has been going on for nearly an hour, Elliot's plane lands in Minnesota, only 15 minutes from the prison. The FBI has a vehicle there waiting for him. Wasting no time, Elliot jumps in the vehicle and races to the prison. From his cell, Jones is able to watch Elliot's arrival. Elliot jumps out of his vehicle, runs to the front gate, and pushes the button on the intercom. He then hears a woman's voice come over the intercom.
Sir, I need you to get back in your vehicle and exit the premises, she says.
I'm Special Agent Roberts with the FBI. I need to come in now.
Sir, we've had a riot breakout in the entire prison, and I'm the only one in the booth. Everyone else is on riot control.
This is a federal matter, ma'am. I need you to open the gate,
Elliot sternly says. After a few moments, she says,
When the gate opens, walk to the door straight ahead, then I will buzz the doors that lead you in my direction.
Elliot follows the buzzing doors until he sees the young lady in the control booth.
What cell block is Harry Jones in?
Elliot asks.
Hold on a second, I'll look. Cell block D,
she answers.
Is that where the riot is taking place?
Jones asks.
No, actually, that's the only cell block not involved.
Get on your radio and call everyone to cell block D. The riot is just a distraction. Jones is about to escape from this prison. Hurry, do it now.
Elliot shouts. She makes the call on the radio.
Tell me the way to cell block D,
Elliot orders. Just as Elliot and a handful of the guards make it to the main door of cell block D, they are rattled by an explosion. After taking a few minutes to gather themselves, they proceed into the cell block.
Which way is Harry Jones' cell?
Elliot yells.
He's on the third tier, 327,
one of the guards replies. Elliot rushes up the metal stairs to cell number 327. Lying on top of the mattress on the bottom bunk is the picture of Elliot Jr. from the newspaper, along with a note addressed to Elliot. The note reads,
Elliot, I sure hope for the sake and safety of your family that you were smart enough not to send your wife and son to her sister's in Rhode Island. Signed, AK.
Elliot quickly runs back downstairs. As the dust and smoke in the air finally begin to settle from one of the cells on the ground floor, Elliot can see a large gaping hole in the side of the building leading straight outside. He goes through the hole, and in the distance, he sees Jones slipping through the second row of the razor wire fences. He notices a younger man holding the fence back while Jones slides through.
The man must have cut the fences while the guards were occupied with the riot,
Elliot thinks to himself. He sprints as fast as he can towards the fence, but before he is able to squeeze through the first row of fences, Jones shoots him in the leg, helplessly laying there. He sees Jones and the young man getting into a small helicopter. As it takes off, a cloud of dust is created through the dust-filled air.
Jones, don't you do it! This isn't over!
Elliot cries out. This has been Hunt or Be Hunted, Burning Desires, written by C.H. Bordelon, narrated by Tommy Carrera. Copyright 2013 by Chris Bordelon. Production copyright 2015 by Barn & Cool Board Publishing. From the authors, I would like to thank you for listening to this work. If you have enjoyed this audiobook, please like us on Facebook at BordelonCooley13. Follow us on Twitter at AllAboutTheBook. And look for Hunt or Be Hunted, Remaining Embers to conclude this series. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please feel free to send us an email at BordelonCooley@yahoo.com. We would love to hear from you.